Introducing the two-way V4, where groundbreaking fuel cell technology meets fresh foam cushioning for the ultimate performance. With fuel cell, each step feels explosive, delivering unparalleled energy return. Paired with fresh foam, experience maximum comfort throughout the game. Its lightweight textile upper offers support and breathability without sacrificing agility. Whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the two-way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the two-way for yourself at newbalance.com.
Welcome back to Composite Two-Star Recruits, a USC recruiting podcast where a couple of one-star hosts talk about 5-, 4-, and 3-star prospects and everything in between. I am your one-star host, Chris Trevino, and as always, I'm joined by my podcasting partner in crime, Gerard Hurricane Martinez. Gerard, we got a packed show for today. We're recording on a Thursday because Wednesday we had USC practice, fall camp. We're in that time of the year where fall camp starts messing up with our summer schedules. We gotta adapt for the fall schedule, and we're gonna talk a little bit about that because you were at a practice, at a Coliseum practice you attended, and everyone wants to get the Hurricane's thoughts on what he saw at USC fall camp practice in the Coliseum. So we're gonna talk about that. We also have to talk about a new bit of breaking news in the NIL space with the new Student Body Right Collective. That news broke this week. And a lot of, you know, message board posts about it, and a lot of headlines about this new collective entering this space for the Trojans. So we're going to talk about that. We got some defensive line news as well. We're going to talk about. We got a whole bunch of listener questions. This might be our most listener questions since week one of this podcast when we asked for questions for a big Q&A. So we got a lot of those to get through, and then we have a commitment talk about. So Gerard, before we jump into it, how you doing?
We have a commitment to talk about. Like, that's the last thing we're going to talk about. It should be the first thing we're talking about. All right, we got Braylon Shelby, one of the top defensive players in the 2023 class that committed to USC last weekend, actually, and we talked about it a lot probably in the two previous podcasts. So obviously it'll be a little bit of rehashing some of what he brings to the table as a prospect and sort of what the impact is for USC down the line. But we usually open up with new commitment. But obviously with fall camp going, you know, everybody starting to turn their attention slowly to the team. You know, now the actual football season is here, and people are starting to think about the actual football team and the wins and losses that will happen on the field this season.
Absolutely. Starting to rev up. You know, people are excited for that September 3rd opening. Get to talk about real football and things we see on the practice field and eventually the Coliseum. But you're right. We do have a commitment. I didn't want to sound like we're the last thing on our minds, but it did happen. You know, almost a week ago, Braylon Shelby, 4-star edge rusher out of Friendswood, Texas, you know, made his commitment last Saturday at a school, did it so on our 24/7 sports YouTube page, which is, you know, new. We're getting a lot of commitments, live commitments done on there. So make sure you go check it out. Go subscribe to that page. Got to plug the home base 247, but came down to USC and the Texas Longhorns. You know, Braylon Shelby was the guy who took an official visit during that big mega weekend in June. It was the guy who I talked to after that visit, and, you know, USC blew it out of the water. You know, he was super impressed by what they did. You know, at one point he was like, I'm having a hard time describing what I saw on that visit. So he was a guy who was a early kind of offer for this staff, a 3-star prospect at that time, but Shelby, 6'4.5", 235 pounds, has seen his stock soar tremendously during the spring and the summer. He's now a consensus 4-star recruit, firmly in the top 247. He jumped in the top 247 in our latest updated rankings to number 156 in the country, the number 18 edge prospect in the country, number 30 prospect out of Texas. He is number 133 in the 24/7 sports composite and the number 15 edge. So this is a very good get for USC in this class. Move them back up to number 12 nationally. And Gerard, you did mention that you did kind of break down his game a little bit in our previous podcast. We were kind of setting the stage for his commitment on Saturday. We felt good about the Trojans. Obviously, that ended up being true. But this is a guy that you really like, Gerard, and a guy you even said that, you know, is still a little bit underrated, you feel, even though he's, you know, made some big jumps in the rankings recently. So, Gerard, everyone wants to know,
can he play?
Yeah, he can play. He can play. He's a very interesting player because he has, you know, legit size at 6'4", 235. We've talked about him in the past being a guy that probably can get up to that 260 range, 265 range. But he also has the athleticism, the agility, and more importantly, just the spatial awareness to be able to probably only be 240, 250 range and be more of a linebacker. So this is one of the few players that we see that are looked at as a hybrid rusher that have the legitimate size to put their hand down and become a weak side defensive end, but also that awareness and space to be able to step off the line of scrimmage and actually make plays at the hash marks. So, you know, it's interesting to see how USC wants to use him. I would say, you know, player comparisons, I see him being less like a Corey Foreman and more like an Eric Gentry in that he's unique because he has that length and that size to be a defensive end, but you watch him in space and you say, man, that would be a little bit of a waste just to put him at the line of scrimmage and have him rush the passer every snap. This is a guy that legitimately you could put out there in the RPO off the line of scrimmage, and you see him play against the option, and he really can play multiple ball carriers at a time. And that's really a tremendous tool to have as a defensive coordinator, to be able to have that guy off the edge that can really sort of babysit that hash mark and not allow the offense to be very decisive about their option game. So, you know, you see him make a lot of plays. I think that he can play sort of multiple positions. You can throw wrinkles out there. Again, play him maybe more like a Sam backer or put him at the line of scrimmage if you're playing against a purely passing team and you just want to get speed upfield. So schematically, I think he fits a lot of different defenses. I think for him, it's really, you know, not as important because I think he could do different things in different defenses, and it's not so much of an issue where you're looking for this unique sort of specific fit. He's a guy that can float out there, and unlike some of the rush ends that USC has recruited in the past and have on the roster and guys that they're even, you know, recruiting right now, because you look at the rest of the board, you've got David Peavy that USC is trying to be able to land. It's really USC and Oregon right now for David Peavy. He's 6'4", 235, but when you watch his film, most of it is at the line of scrimmage. He has the speed on paper to be able to play a little more of a hybrid spot, a little bit more linebacker spot. Interestingly enough, 24/7 Sports has him rated as a linebacker, yet he almost entirely plays rush end on film. Whereas Braylon Shelby, I would argue, is more of a linebacker. In fact, he was an all-district outside linebacker for his team there at Friendswood. So he's really more of a linebacker and has shown more that he can be a linebacker, meaning he can play off the line of scrimmage, he can play in space, he can cover, he can do some different things, whereas PB's been more of a just get upfield out of a two-point stance rush end, hybrid rush end, but still a rush end. And then you have Mateo Ungalale, who really, you know, kind of plays a five technique standing up, does a little wide side seven technique as well for St. John Bosco. But to me, is a guy that really needs to have his hand on the ground. He needs to be playing defensive end. He needs to be more of a traditional go upfield defensive end. I would compare him more with a Drake Jackson. I think defensive line is really where he has to hang his hat at the next level. And you know, we've seen him play a lot of tight end. I think early in his career, he was looking to play tight end, to be a tight end. But as time has gone on and he's, you know, 270 now, I think defensive line has sort of become a little bit more of where his ceiling is going to be the highest position wise. And I feel like that's a situation where he could go somewhere and people are going to sell him on, oh yeah, man, you're skilled enough to play outside linebacker. And kids like to hear that. We've already said, you know, if you're a defensive end, you want to hear about how athletic you are and how you can play linebacker. If you're a linebacker, you want to hear about how great in coverage you are and how athletic you are, you can play safety. If you're a safety, you want to hear about how great in coverage you are and how athletic you are, and you can actually play corner. They always want to go up to the position that is looked at and identified as being more athletic, right? But if the truth of the matter is, you sometimes have a certain skill set that is better for one position or the other. And we saw that with Drake Jackson. The Drake Jackson experiment, I don't think worked for USC. I think they wasted a lot of reps with him playing in the flats and playing in the curls when he should have had his hand on the ground and he should have been one gap attacking the quarterback. He had natural pass rushing skills, and just this real innate ability to kind of feel himself around blocks. And that kind of stuff just gets it's not used when you're playing in the two-point stance and you're sort of trying to read, am I going off into the flats? Am I attacking the line of scrimmage? What am I doing as this quasi outside linebacker, which USC just basically called a rush end? You know, other schools have called it the buck spot. You've heard predator. You know, there's a lot of different names for that particular position. For this defense that Alex Grinch is running, to our knowledge, it's just being called a rush end. And then the other side is going to be the defensive end, which is the Nick Figueroa side of things.
Right.
I kind of feel like that's where Mateo needs to be. That's the position that Mateo needs to be. It's not like you can't peel him off in a zero blitz and a zone blitz and have him do some things, because he has great footwork and he has athleticism and he's got good ball skills. He's actually a pretty decent tight end catching the ball, but that's a lot of sort of you're doing a little bit of this and doing a little bit of that, and that takes away from your ability to focus in on what you do best and building that craft and becoming better at that, because he's not a super dominant football player right now in high school. He's a five-star, but he has not been like a dominant player at St. John Bosco. So I think a lot of that has to do with him just moving positions and kind of taking reps and spots and doing things that, you know, it's nice. It's nice to showcase your talent and your ability at those positions and show your versatility. But at the end of the day, you know, you've got a certain body type and you've got a certain skill set, and that needs to be bolstered and that needs to be reinforced by playing, you know, one position and focus on it more. And I think that's inevitably what's going to happen in college. And if it goes to a school that really utilizes him and goes with what he can do as a pass rusher and a defensive lineman and let him get stronger, gain that weight, and use that finesse skill ability to be a good pass rusher, that's going to be where you see his ceiling the highest. So I look at him and Braylon Shelby as being pretty different football players. They're both rated as rush ends, but kind of different football players in terms of what they do on the field.
And Shelby, very, very athletic, as you mentioned. You know, he's kind of a dual sport guy as well. Not kind of, he is a dual sport athlete, competes on the track in the triple jump. And he's been a Texas qualifier as well. So, you know, that kind of matches these sort of player profiles that the defense and the whole coaching staff has gone after with these multi-sport athletes for this defense and this team in general. He fills up the stat sheet. You know, last year he had 77 tackles, 12 tackles for a loss, 8 sacks, 5 pass breakups, 4 forced fumbles, and had a pick 6. So this guy just makes plays all over the field, and he's a really good get. And I know, Gerard, you had mentioned it last week that this is one of the best guys on the board that USC could get and could add to this class. And Gerard, that brings the class to 15. I'm feeling great for my number 16 pick, for my number 16 commits by the time the season opener. You're getting there. You're 3 away. So I think I'm going to get it. You are a little bit on the outside looking in.
Okay.
I'm glad you don't have any money on this. Is all I'm gonna say.
I just you know you're just already taking your victory lap, and you know what happens though if they go one over 16, you know, 17.
Oh, is that a bust? It busts. Is that how we're doing it? We never went over this.
A little blackjack here, or I mean, I don't know. I know is you're already patting yourself on the back. That's all I can hear.
Look, all I'm saying is I feel great. I feel great right now. And USC fans feel great about this one, mainly because it is a defensive front player. And those are kind of the players that, you know, USC fans have been sort of pining for. You know, they get a lot of receivers. They got running backs. You know, cornerbacks, defensive backs, not really a worry position for them with Dante Williams back there. Those linebackers, those edge rushers, those defensive linemen, those are kind of the ones they want to see on USC's board. And to get a guy like Braylon Shelby is huge. Obviously pair him with sort of the future and sort of Tackett Curtis as that Mike spot, that the future Mike backer for this defense. I think it's a great, great start for, you know, this linebacker core, this edge rushing core, this defensive front core. So another good pickup. You know, we're looking into the horizon. You know, there's some other guys who might come off the board soon, Alani Noah being one of them. And Gerard, this is another win. You know, we're not going to get super into it, because we still have a wait. We have to wait before we can truly break it down. But this is a win for the June 16th mega weekend. You know, as Jalen was on that one.
When everybody was ready to, you know, jump off a ledge there, you know, a few weeks after that weekend, because some of the bigger players that they had in Lucas Simmons and Francis Mongoa didn't commit to USC. And obviously there was a lot of talk of certain other guys going other places, you know, like Walker Lyons goes to Stanford. There were some guys that, you know, you thought USC had a good shot at that went elsewhere, but some of these guys where you're a little more on the fence and thinking, okay, you know, this might go, you know, the other way against USC, have committed to USC. And we've seen USC build some momentum here late. And you also have Edric Hill floating around out there who may make a decision pretty soon as well. And that would be, I mean, at this point, par for the course would really be allowing Noah going to Oregon and Edric Hill committing to USC. That's kind of almost sort of how it's gone the past month or so in terms of, you know, the guys are ending up at USC away from USC. Obviously, I mean, I think we felt like for the past couple weeks that Shelby was starting to trend more towards USC. So it wasn't a surprise. But after he took his Texas official visit, which was the last official visit that he took, you know, everybody felt like, okay, he's probably going to go to Texas. I think Texas sources were very confident in that. But then, you know, it started to stretch out a little more, and you had Arch Manning commit, and you had a little bit of momentum building for them, and then there was nothing from Shelby, and that certainly became a little bit of a red flag for them. And so, we're waiting to see what happens with Sacramento Grant offensive guard Alani Noah. He's very close with Micah Benuelos, who committed earlier to USC in July, and we're going to see if, you know, that there's a little bit of a package deal sort of thing going on there. You know, there was a lot of friendships made, and there were some connections made with that group on the offensive line. Obviously, you know, with Francis, him going to Miami, that sort of breaks it up. Lucas Simmons was there as well. But you got the sense that with Amos Talalele and Micah Benuelos and now Alani Noah, that those three, that was sort of the interior group, and there was a connection there. And it'll be interesting to see, like, going forward, if that does not keep USC with a foot in the door with Francis Mongoa down the line, just because there seemed to be a bit of connection there with that group, a poly group. And that would be, you know, pretty big for USC to be able to at least get to a point where they have, you know, the initial core of the offensive line committed coming out of the summer. And then you move forward and you still have to try to land one of those franchise type offensive tackles, obviously.
Gerard, is it safe to call, or would you call USC a hot team on the recruiting trail? Four commitments. They've won their last four battles, or guys that have been up for commitments. And over the last 25 days, so four commitments in about a month, would you consider them a hot team on the trail right now?
Warming up. You know, I don't know if I would say hot in this day and age when, you know, you've got your Miamis of the world just, you know, landing five stars consecutively. I think they're warming up, certainly. And, you know, you want to see them be able to land Alani Noah and, again, kind of get the core of that offensive line sort of settled. And then you see, okay, where can we go? Do we circle the wagons here on one of these guys that is committed elsewhere? Do we continue to try to spin our wheels on Lucas Simmons or Francis Mongoa, or do we go in another direction and see if there's some other top rated offensive tackle that would like to take an official visit to USC that hasn't previously really been seriously looking at USC. So they have to make that determination, but I would say, yeah, I mean, USC certainly warmed up. You know, the Takis Curtis commitment was huge for them. We knew that when it happened, that was one that you could easily see going, you know, Ohio State's way, and USC beat Ohio State and Wisconsin head to head for him. Here, USC beats Texas head to head, which has not happened since probably 2006 with Emmanuel Moody. I can't remember where USC was actually going head to head for a Texas kid against Texas and actually beat Texas out. So that's saying a lot. I mean, that's a big, big ask going against those two schools, which have had a lot of recruiting success over the years. Texas obviously hasn't been as good over the past few years as a football program. So you're not necessarily competing against the proven commodity that their coaching staff is or their program has been, like Ohio State or an Alabama. But nevertheless, you're talking about a Texas kid that Texas wants and they're pushing after hard. And so that I think that's a big win for USC, just statement wise. You know, they've gone and gotten two out of state recruits and they've gone head to head against some big boys and they won out.
Technically three if we're counting Micah out of Washington.
Yeah, true. Yeah, against Oregon. And Oregon, you know, we talked about it then. Oregon has been plaguing USC head-to-head for offensive line recruits. And it's probably going to be another head-to-head battle with Alani Noah. It looked like Oregon was on the outs with him. They were pushing him to commit early, and he decided to balk on that. And it looked like Oregon wasn't going to really be involved. They were going to move on and maybe try to get somebody else. But they circled the wagons on that and said, hey, we really want you to come in and take an official visit. And there was some talk that maybe, you know, they even used Michael Banuelos to try to get Alani Noah to visit Oregon. So, you know, again, they have a pretty close relationship, and we'll see if that's something that's going to help USC, because Banuelos actually committed to USC.
So nice little run here, Braylon Shelby. Huge pickup, you know, a guy who can have a huge senior season out there at Friendswood and see his stock even rise even more, maybe into the top 100. If he gets another good season where he's getting at that pass rusher, getting at that QB, excuse me. So, Gerard, I think that's going to wrap up our cold open with the Braylon Shelby talk. And it's time to get into something that a theme that we've talked about a lot on Composite Two-Star Recruits. I know it's a topic that has, you know, gotten you off the rails sometimes. You know, we've gone into these different directions and had these sort of overarching themes when we talk about this, it being NIL. And we had a big NIL news break specifically for the Trojans this week, which, you know, it's what everyone's talking about this week outside of fall practice, and that is the Student Body Right Collective. News broke earlier this week. The LA Times did a story about how a collective, a quote-unquote official collective, if you will, we can talk a little bit more of that when we get into this, but a new collective is coming to USC that is Student Body Right. That is the official name. It's run by two, you know, USC super fans, Dale Reck and Bill Haddon. I believe that's the pronunciation. But they are the sort of faces of this new organization. And, you know, there's a lot to talk about here. But this is something that's created sort of a interesting discussion with USC and obviously the Boulevard and their sort of collective plus status, because the big thing with this is that USC does not officially sort of support this new collective. This is something that they wanted to stay away from, because obviously the term collective has sort of this negative connotation. It's obviously a dirty word right now in the NIL and the college football athletics, and what it could mean when the NCAA decides to maybe step in. So Student Body Right, you know, a little bit controversial right now, but I know some USC fans are really excited about it because, you know, USC has sort of been in the middle of the NIL space and not really knowing which direction they want to go in. Lincoln Riley has said as much, where he feels like they'd be positioned to go into a full kind of donor-based collective or the more marketing thing, which is kind of what the Boulevard is. So right now we have these two entities, Student Body Right, the Boulevard. They have different, you know, organizational things. They have different plans of operation, and we're going to get into those a little bit. But you have these two heavyweights right now looking at each other, Gerard, and, you know, it kind of feels standoffish just because, you know, USC is not officially supporting Student Body Right. And I guess I just want to get what your kind of reaction is to this big NIL update.
I don't know that I have a reaction. It's obviously an interesting situation that is unfolding, because as we've sort of touched on in the past, there's been some frustration with USC in the NIL space. And that's not just come from the boosters, which has obviously resulted in this collective that is run by the donors and the boosters, but also from recruits and people from that side of the table. So this almost felt like an inevitability, that there would be some, I don't know if I would call them impatient, but there would be some boosters that want to have something that mirrors what other schools have, which has been successful primarily in recruiting. You know, how successful it is or it isn't in terms of paying players that are on the current college rosters is a little harder to tell. The really only way to look at that would be with the transfer portal and watching to see, you know, who's staying where and who's transferring where. I think that would dictate more of players being unhappy maybe with potential NIL opportunities at one school over the other. But with recruiting, and obviously this is a recruiting podcast, we've seen the emergence of the Texas A&M collectives, the Miami collectives, the Tennessee collective, Michigan State, and Oregon with Division Street. There's a few different collectives which are run by the donors, and they have been at the forefront with recruiting and not just the players on the football roster.
Right.
So the distinction here with student body right to how we understand it right now is that it's not going to be involved with recruiting, at least out of the gates. Their primary focus is going to be more towards players who are going to be enrolled at USC. Now, that could still have obviously an impact on recruiting. We talked about this last week. There's been a bit of a divide between some of these schools that even have collectives. The ones that have come forward and want to pay players, recruits, that is, up front for commitments with a potential contract for enrollment. So you're talking about recruits being paid money up front and that being something to lure them into a commitment, which lures them into an eventual signing. Whereas other schools have decided, listen, we have NIL opportunities, we have money, we have contracts and things that you can be a part of, but you have to enroll in order to have that opportunity and to be able to be paid by us, which would obviously fall more into the parameters of what the NCAA wants. Right. But nevertheless, you have schools that are doing both. And so there's a little bit of this divide that's happening. There's a little bit of this sort of, you know, the schools that we've seen that have had a lot of success in recruiting, you know, this cycle have been those who have been more aggressive. And the talk is that's because they're putting some money up front. Now, we talked a little bit about that last week. I'm not going to rehash the pros and cons of that and how that eventually, you know, plays out with college football and the NCAA and what their bylaws state and what the NCAA is even going to become here in the next few years. And, you know, what college football looks like in the next few years with all of this evolving. But certainly we've talked about how fluid this situation is. And I think just looking at Boulevard and the relationship with USC and what Boulevard has been kind of is emblematic of how fluid it is, because Boulevard, you know, early on, it seemed like everybody involved with that, including USC administration, stayed away from calling it a collective altogether. It was right. Not called a collective. I was told, you know, this is not a collective. People were discouraged from looking at it or being passed off as a collective. It was something different.
It's a dirty word, Gerard. Dirty word.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I would go that far. I know that there is that connotation because of things that other schools are doing. But like I said, there are collectives that are not necessarily pushing the envelope on, you know, paying high school kids before they actually enroll or paying them just specifically to go to a certain school. Like, all of these things are really not legal if you look at what the NCAA bylaws are and what the NCAA has stated forward. So, you know, Boulevard has been far from that. And certainly it's been something unique unto itself. But then just recently, the LA Times had tweeted something about the Boulevard not being collective, basically correcting someone, and then only to be corrected by the head of Boulevard, Mike Jones, saying it's a common misconception, but the Boulevard is a collective, but it's a collective plus. Now, that's the first time I've ever heard that.
Right.
So, and I've been paying attention. That's the first time I've ever heard that. So we're already seeing an evolution even of the Boulevard. And that evolution is obviously moving more towards the collective idea and concept, and maybe less away from this agency concept, which originally that's how I feel it was being sold. Now, maybe that's just my misconception, but you know, I'm a recruiting writer. I do this. If I'm confused by it, then guess what? A lot of people are probably confused by it. And it's easy to be confused because, like I said, it's fluid. There's a lot of moving parts to NIL. And USC is doing a good job trying to position themselves in this. And I totally understand Boulevard and the concept and why USC would go in that direction. Now, it's very unique. And I think it's probably not a great sign that no other schools have really adopted that. I mean, you can look at it two ways, right? You can look at it one way and say, well, you know what? USC is being innovative. They're being a catalyst and they're coming up with a new idea to do something different that's still effective. That's great. That's fantastic. And I think that's kind of Brandon Sosna's baby. I'm sure Brandon and Spencer Harris and those guys that were there in the personnel office, they kind of were coming up with something knowing that NIL was coming. And I think being proactive in that space is great. I mean, that's what you want to see as a Trojan fan. But then you kind of wait and wait and wait, and you're looking around nationally to go, okay, is nobody else doing it that way? You know, everybody else kind of seems to be going towards the donor booster-led collectives because probably that's just the most efficient way to get the money to the players. You know, you've got the people with the checkbooks that are kind of running the show, and there's not this middleman. However, the good part about Boulevard, and this is why I think USC took this approach, is because there is a buffer there. And if you're going by what the NCAA says and wants, and you're interpreting their rules more literally, then you don't want your boosters and your donors directly involved with business deals with your players, and certainly not with recruits. That's against NCAA rules. But it just seems like the climate is the rules that are now will no longer be. And I think everybody kind of feels like this thing is changing. It's changing quickly. And all those interpretations are archaic. And that's just not how college football is going to be in the future.
And yeah, you're right. In terms of, you know, the NCAA rules and stuff, Dale and Bill, who were recently on the Peristyle podcast, they did an interview with Ryan. And you can listen to that anywhere, you know, you download this podcast. You likely already heard it. But if you haven't, that's a really good interview. So check that out. They talk a lot about the origins of this thing and kind of why they decided to get it going now. And they answer some questions from that Peristyle member suggested or wrote in. So go check that interview out. It's up there right now. You can check it out. Download it after you finish this one, of course. But yeah, they really kind of stressed Dale and Bill that they would, quote, like, never reach out to a high school prospect. This is only for academically eligible current players, and there is a quid pro quo for this sort of quote unquote base salary that they're hoping to build with this collective, pay every player, including walk-ons, this sort of base salary, but they must provide, the players must provide NFL services to kind of be compensated for this base pay, whether that be, you know, community service. I think that was a big one they really hit on. They want these players to sort of be part of the community and to get out there in the community. And these guys were really hitting on the fact that they are doing everything kind of by the book as it's outlined by the NCAA and their sort of instructions for NIL and that such. And mainly NIL, for the NCAA is concerned, kind of throws it down to the state, the individual state laws, which is something kind of we've talked about and how, you know, laws are changing at the state level to kind of maybe protect against future NIL legislation. But these guys were talking about how they everything they did for this collective, or they will be doing for this collective, because it's not expected to hit until or be a thing really until 2023. That's when it's supposed to be up and running officially. But it's all based off, you know, the California law, the Fair Play to Play Act that was passed by Gavin Newsom in California. So everything there and this collective is kind of based on that in terms of their interpretation of the rules laid out by that piece of legislation. So for them, you know, their mission here is to kind of take care of the kids. They want them to be part of the Trojan family. And again, they really hit that this is for players enrolled and not for student athlete. This is not what we're doing in terms of, you know, going after high school recruiting or high school prospects. So they kind of drew that line in the sand about what this thing actually is. And obviously we're going to see, you know, how that grows and continues, especially in 2023 when this happens. But as I mentioned, the most interesting thing about this, I feel like, is that, you know, USC is not on board with this. Mike Bone, athletic director, was kind of LA Times for their story. They reached out to him to get sort of a reaction or a quote from him. And his reaction, this was his direct reaction, quote, "Earlier this year, USC worked with State Data to create Boulevard LLC, an agency and media company that provides NIL services to all USC student athletes. USC is not aware of a former donor-created NIL collective. We ask any donors who would like to support USC's athletes through NIL to please work with Boulevard so that all activities are conducted in compliance with state laws and NCAA rules." So, you know, kind of reading between the lines here, it's like Mike Bone, USC is not really they're kind of acting like, you know, student body right isn't a thing. Now, is he actually not aware of a former donor-based NIL collective? I wouldn't go that far. As the AD of USC, I'm sure this was on his radar, but it is an interesting quote to kind of put out there in terms of steering people to the Boulevard and, you know, wanting to be compliant or with the state laws and NCAA rules and all that kind of such. So it's sort of, we have it written down here as sort of NIL civil war, because now we have these two bodies that are kind of going to be looking at each other from across the way, student body right versus Boulevard. What's right? What's going to work? What's going to end up being the true collective in the USC space, whether that's a true collective or the NIL plus with the Boulevard?
The thing that you hope doesn't happen is there's some type of civil war that goes on here between the donor base, which, you know, student body right was, from my understanding, being promoted and backed by Brian Kennedy.
Right. He is involved. He is on record as being involved. Yeah.
Being one of the more outspoken boosters for USC. So that's interesting, you know, that he wouldn't see the model that Boulevard has. And as we said before, the business model for Boulevard has changed. It's not what it was at its outset. And so it has evolved, and it has evolved probably because of some of this pressure and some of the boosters not maybe feeling like it's an efficient enough model. And so that's going to be something to watch carefully. Are we going to see a watered down effort because you have different factions of the donor base backing, you know, one or the other? Is it good because you have those options? Does Boulevard become better because of student body right, or do they again sort of divide the booster base to some extent? And again, yeah, I think that's, with Mike Bone's comment, more of a shot over the bow, in my opinion. I mean, I don't think you can be unaware of this going on. Now, USC supposedly had another collective type of donor alumni run organization with NIL that was going on with Sam Baker and Frosty Rucker for linemen. And we haven't heard much about that lately. And you actually, Chris, got wind of that very early on. And I don't know if that was just discouraged by USC and they decided not to do it, or where that currently stands. But it is interesting that USC wants to sort of go through Boulevard. And I think part of this is also USC being USC. They want to control the money to a certain extent. And I've heard frustrations with that from boosters and even coaches in the past. Not so much with this administration, but in the past, that has been an issue. And that's been an issue of middlemen, administrators getting involved, and that money dispersing and kind of getting lost in the system and not necessarily going specifically to what the boosters want to see that money go towards. And again, I'll bring up the Phil Knight expose that Oregon Live did, which talked about how he wrote checks and how he got things done with the athletic department at Oregon and how involved he was. And it was not a matter of him writing a $10 million check and saying, okay, here you go, Joe Blow administrator. I want this to go towards the basketball program. And it $6 million of it goes towards the basketball program. And $4 million just gets kind of lost into the system. And that's the sort of bureaucracy that you have to deal with universities, more state universities and private run universities. But nevertheless, you got a lot of people there. And I think with Phil Knight, he learned early on, I'm going to walk this check to the person that I want to cash it. And I think that may be some of where you get the boosters wanting to run their own show. Because at the end of the day, if they have an opportunity to support the program, but do it more directly, and it's within NCAA guidelines, they're probably going to take that route. Because these are private sector businessmen. Okay, these are people that they don't work for the government. They don't work for the state. They don't work for bureaucracies. They don't have patience for that. So I understand sort of that attitude as, listen, this is my money and I want it to go to this specific place. I want to make sure it goes to this specific place. I'm not going to spend, $1 million and have half of it or 30% of it just sort of end up, somewhere else. That it was not the intention. That was not what it was originally for. So
can I read the LA Times quote that deals directly with this?
Yeah, go ahead.
And like you were just talking about, but this is a quote from the LA Times story, but the Boulevard presentations also raised concerns from some donors about where the money would be allocated. As explained during the meeting, only 50% of any given donation would be allocated where the donor chose, while the other 50% would be set aside in Boulevard's general fund to be allocated however Boulevard saw fit. And that's sort of kind of what you've mentioned with this whole your Phil Knight story and analogy, that they want to know where that money goes. They don't want it just to be write the check and forget about it. They want to see it wherever that may be.
Yeah, and Boulevard has employees. It has overhead. Mm-hmm. It's a company, right? And again, I think from USC's point of view, that's a good buffer between boosters and players and recruits, et cetera. It provides them a bit of cover to say, listen, anything that's done, it was done with an objective group that was not just trying to manipulate or do something which is against NCAA rules, which is that word that we always use, inducement. Okay, that's what you want to stay away from at this point in time. Maybe it's not like that in the future, but at this point in time, inducement is the dirty word. That's what you can't do. You can't say, here's a bunch of money as a recruit. If you go to this school, if you start at this school, if you become an All-American at this school, we'll give you a bonus. That is inducement to get that recruit to go to that specific school. And that is still against the NCAA rules. But yeah, there are differences between student body right and their difference between Boulevard. Now that 50%, to my knowledge, and I'm only going by what discussions I've seen about it on the message board recently, has been taken down, I believe, to zero. I don't think that's a thing anymore, or is it maybe just less now? I haven't kept up with the numbers, but as I said, Boulevard is evolving. There's right. Some things at the outset. This is how the business model looked, and the money was not probably being funneled quite the way that the people that were writing the checks wanted it to be. And so they've adjusted with that. So they've been flexible enough. They're kind of trying to learn and trying to probably work with these donors, because that's ultimately what makes it go. The donors are what makes it go, especially at a private school like USC, where you're not getting a bunch of state funding.
And kind of something that Dale and Bill talked about on Student Body Right is that they don't really have overhead like the Boulevard. They kind of said that, anytime they needed something within this donor base, someone has done it pro bono. Obviously there's a lot of smart, wealthy donors with a lot of time on their hands who offer their expertise and skills. So that's sort of kind of what it's been like, at least for early on for Student Body Right. And we'll see if that continues with SBR in the future. But I kind of wanted to ask, because this is kind of a thing that's popping up with these new collectives, and something that Student Body Right is doing is applying for nonprofit status, 501c nonprofit accreditation. I don't know if that's the right term, accreditation, but that's something they're I believe they've applied for and trying to, you know, add to their resume for this thing. So how do you see kind of that route affecting student body right, you know, as it goes against, maybe not against, but alongside Boulevard, which is a profit organization?
Well, again, right now, because things are so fluid and moving so fast, it's a guerrilla war. It's not a conventional war. In other words, you have to be mobile and you have to be flexible. And it's probably a little tougher for a corporation, a company that does other things as well, to move as fast as a group of guys who, that's their money, right? It's like, you can call whoever and say, hey, you know, this is a group. We have this money. Listen, we need to make this move now because, you know, this is what we need to do financially.
There's
to
no make red an tape. Impact
for the team. Right. There's no red tape. There's no, you know, the protocols are really stripped down. Now, in the future, it may benefit. And this is kind of what USC, again, I keep going back to things I've already said in the past, but it's good to try to kind of bring those ideas back to, you know, the current state, because, you know, things have changed a little bit. But USC wants to sort of look at this long term. This has always sort of been long game for USC when it comes to Boulevard. And, you know, they're going to suffer to some extent with that if that's the only approach that they take, because you do have these other schools that are being much more aggressive. They're being they're taking more risks. If you believe that the NCAA is going to come in and they're going to actually review any of this stuff, and they're going to actually try to penalize teams that may have been walking the line on that nasty word inducement, right? I mean, if you're paying kids up front to go to a school, relocate their families, and say, here's, you know, let's just say $50,000 up front, probably a lot more than that, and then we'll give you such and such $1 million when you actually enroll. I mean, that's absolutely inducement. There's no way around it. There's no way that that agreement, whether it's on paper or not, it cannot be, you're giving that money to go to this school. We're not just giving you $50,000 because we think you're a really good player and, you know, we want you to sign some autographs. It's, you know, to go to a specific school. And like I said before, and I don't want to rehash the whole conversation we had about it, but I don't see where collectives would have any legal backing truly in that situation if a kid decided to decommit and take that upfront money and say, go kick rocks. Because at the end of the day, you're going to have to take them to civil court. And if you take them to civil court, all of that financial information is going to be on the table for the NCAA to review. So again, now their long game look may be that the NCAA isn't going to exist in 3 or 4 years. You know, like what investigation and what actual case will ever be filed and will ever go to a point where you get to the committee of infractions when the NCAA is not going to be the NCAA in the future? Okay, that might be the long game that Miami and Tennessee and Texas A&M and those schools are looking at, whereas USC is looking at the long game with the NCAA still in mind. So that's kind of sort of the difference between some of these schools and their approach to all of this. But when it comes to Boulevard versus the collective SBR, certainly SBR is going to be able to move faster and quicker. And it, I mean, the money is with the people that are making the decisions, whereas Boulevard, they don't have the money. They are there to create a model or a format for getting the money to the players. So yeah, there's a gap there. There's a certain gap there. And so SBR will be able to move quicker and faster. Granted, it's not going to be up and running this year. So we'll see. There's a long ways to, you know, to go between now and 2023. And again, USC university-wise seems to be discouraging this. Now, are they discouraging this publicly so they have an out in case collectives and that approach are deemed to break rules by the NCAA? And they can say, listen, we tried. You know, we have deniability here because we were not involved with this directly. Or is it actual, we want to go through Boulevard for whatever reasons, you know, for us just as a university, we're more comfortable with these people And this is sort of a something. I mean, I don't know financially if USC gets anything out of Boulevard, if there's any investment with them and stay doubted. That's you know, not to my knowledge. But again, I mean, there may be an actual reason why USC says, no, this is what we're doing. It may change. Boulevard may become something completely different, but it's going to be Boulevard. That is going to be whatever deals with NIL, no matter what. You know, we're not necessarily sure how that plays out. And certainly it's something that, again, is happening in a space that is just moving so quickly.
And I guess we're sort of winding down on this student body discussion and Boulevard discussion, but I guess my final sort of thing to look at, whether that it be in the future, you know, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, for what, six months from now, I don't know. We don't know. But do you think NIL, I guess specifically USC's NIL strategy, do you think that these two bodies can coexist together? Do you think they could merge at some point? Or is it like a monopoly and only one can kind of survive this war?
Well, that's a good question. And that kind of, I touched on that a little bit. You know, you don't want to see a civil war boosters who feel like, well, no.
You need a united front. You don't want a fractured donor base or whatever.
Exactly. You don't want, you know, some boosters saying, well, no, this is the way it should be. And I talked to this guy at Boulevard and he says, you know, that's not legal. That's going to get USC in trouble. And then the other guys are like, well, no, we don't agree with that. And we don't think that this is not illegal. And our interpretation is different than USC's compliance interpretations, because God knows when it comes to NCAA interpretations, every freaking school on the effing planet has a different interpretation of everything. So, you know, and that in and of itself is just frustrating for me as a reporter, because, you know, we do things all the time at USC and there's things that we can't do that other reporters at other schools can do. And it's just like, how do those rules, how can they be interpreted? Like, there should be no interpretation, man. You run a red light, you ran a damn red light. That is it. There's no interpretation to that. And yet it seems with NCAA bylaws, there's plenty of room for interpretation. And that's another issue with this. Not only are we dealing with something new and something that from a litigation standpoint is all over the place, just the schools themselves, how they're interpreting these things, clearly from a compliance standpoint, USC feels more comfortable with the communication and relationship that they have with Boulevard. Now, Boulevard is not a part of USC. Originally, when it was created, it sort of seemed like it was a program within USC, but it's not. And Boulevard is, like we said, it's a subsidiary of Stay Doubted, which interestingly enough, I never heard of Stay Doubted until after I heard of Boulevard, but Stay Doubted is the parent company. So Stay Doubted does other things. So again, from a buffer standpoint, it's definitely much safer approach for USC to do things through that. Now, I would say in terms of coalescing, you know, if SBR is focused on the student athlete that's at USC, I think from a compliance standpoint, that is a bit more straightforward. You know, what you can and can't do, and dealing with compliance at USC, I think will be a little more straightforward. Recruiting is where it gets real, real murky. That's where things get really vague and ambiguous, and all the different characters within a recruitment that you have to deal with, and you're dealing with kids. That might be better for Boulevard from the approach of, you know, better safe than sorry, and making sure that things are done a certain way, and more recruits need the actual branding. You know, certainly there are those guys like Malachi Nelson and Nicholas Harbor. The top 5-star guys are going to have agents, and they're going to have agency representation, and they're going to have a team of people around them that will help them build their brand. They don't need that from Boulevard. But there are plenty of other guys like Alani Noah, like Grant Buckey, like even maybe even Tackett Curtis, that could benefit quite a lot from a company that not only helps them land NIL, but helps them make themselves a better brand ambassador for more deals, and sort of coaches them up on how to do that. Now, you know, that takes a lot, and it takes some time. It takes some coaching, and I don't know how in depth Boulevard gets with that, but certainly from the recruiting standpoint, and not to say that that's lost on certain players. You know, I think Shotgun pointed out at practice, the first practice when you guys spoke to the team, and Tuli Pulotu talked a little bit after practice. And Tuli's been a guy that's just a man of few words. You know, he's not super comfortable with talking to the media and never has been. But Shotgun said, you know, it seemed like he was really working on that. Now, I don't want to give credit to Boulevard, you know, when I don't know that they help with that. But that's something that I could see them doing. And I could see them helping some of those players just become a little more comfortable on camera and knowing the responsibilities and an accountability that you have to have when you have partnerships. This is something that's very big. And again, it's big for players on the team, but it's also huge for recruits who are on social media and can say stupid shit. And that stuff can hurt you with people that are paying you money. You lose sponsorships overnight if you say dumb things on social media. Maybe you get on there and you're like, hey, man, I love this rap lyric. And you put that up there out of context, which kids do all the time. And it's just a bad look. It's not something that company wants to be associated with. And so they need education from that front as to how to conduct yourself, how to handle yourself in the public eye, because now you are a professional and you are making money as a professional. So people are going to start looking at you like that, regardless of whether you're 34 or you're 24 or you're 17.
34, was that a reference to Ben Griffiths?
That was a reference to, you know, the differences between people and their maturity levels. And, sure. You know, like I said, I think if you're looking at how they can coalesce and work, I do feel like Boulevard offers certain things as a collective plus. And I think the plus is the fact that they are sort of an agency that can brand build. And they're not just like, here is a check for however much money to go to this school. That's not what they're doing. What they're offering is an ability to make more money down the line, you know, more money, not just, you know, now, not just 3 years from now, but potentially if you have that ability to go to the NFL, there's a lot of information and there's a lot of tools that we can give you to make you even bigger down the line. You know, you could be the next Juju Smith. And so that's something that is big. And I think on the recruiting front is probably a tool that Boulevard has that certainly SBR does not have. And SBR, like I said, at this point is not being involved or approaching the recruiting process whatsoever. They're saying that they're going to reinforce the financial backing and support of players that are on the team. Whereas Boulevard will certainly, I have to assume, be involved somewhat with the recruiting process. I mean, I know talking to Malachi Nelson's people that they've talked to some of the Boulevard people, and there's been, you know, conversations there. And I think that's something that Boulevard offers from the recruiting standpoint that collectives do not. You know, it's a bigger picture sort of deal. But like I said, it is for, I think, a majority of recruits, but the guys that are getting paid the big money, the five-star guys, the top 100 guys, maybe not as much, because a good chunk of those guys are going to end up having their own people that want to do their own thing and have their own ideas about how to brand build.
So I think that's a good place to end for our talk on NIL, collectives, student body right, Boulevard, and hopefully not an NIL civil war. I just want to give a quick shout out to the Parastyle user IM2Trojan, who had a really nice, concise summarization of student body right and Boulevard that we use as sort of a talking point for our docket here for the show. So shout out IM2Trojan on the Parastyle for a nice succinct write-up of the two collectives NIL entities. Gerard, I think we should hit on a couple more things before we take our break.
Okay, whatever, we can go straight through, man. We don't need a break, buddy. We don't need
Okay.
We can do two-a-days. Okay. Are those outlawed yet? Are those outlawed?
Those are outlawed. I don't think you can do two-a-days anymore, man. All right. Do you have any good two-a-days stories?
In high school, man.
Do you have any good two-a-day stories?
Let's just keep talking over each other so we can hear each other.
I was saying, do you have any good two-a-day stories?
No, not any.
Come
any
on,
day.
Hurricane.
I just remember sleeping in the gym. We had 3 days. We had 3 days in high school. We had the morning practice, which started at 7, which was way too early to be practicing football on wet grass in the IE, and that humidity picks up as the heat picks up. And then we come out and we do special team practices in the middle of the day, like at noon. And it wasn't terrible, but I mean, you're running up and down kickoff. It kind of sucked.
You had specific special teams practice? What are you, Clay Helton run team?
We did. Yeah, John Baxter was our special teams coach.
Okay.
We came out there with crash test dummies and flags and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, so we had like an hour and a half special teams like in the heat of the day. And then we come back out at like, I think it was 6:30 for our evening practice, which was always the best. You know, practicing under the lights is freaking awesome, especially during the summer. It's still warm outside and stuff. So, yeah, those were cool. And then, you try to go to sleep, you know, sleeping in the gym in your sleeping bag. And then you wake up. If we watch, you know, of course, the program, you know, we have some type of movie. And I remember for the plug for the projector was always like in the back by the door. And people always, you know, like, want to loiter outside for whatever reason, even though it was still freaking, you know, 85 degrees outside and it was cool in the gym. Everybody always just had to do that. It was just, you know, we're teenagers, we're kids. Nobody's just going to lay down and watch a movie.
You so want to loiter. Every teenager wants loiter. To loiter.
We just go out the door and hang out over there. And the stupid plug was always there and people would always kick it. And you would just get so hazed. if you knock that plug out, even though there's only five people probably watching the movie, oh man, you would just get hazed by pillows, and maybe there might be a soap bar in that pillow or something. So hazing was still a thing back then for us. But and you'd wake up way too early, and they'd have pancakes, make a bunch of giant pancakes for us, and then, you know, back out there, and inevitably somebody be puking up their creatine from you know, the morning practice, and that's how it went. It was just that. There was no, I don't remember any like stories. I just remember that.
You remember thing. The feelings. You remember the experiences.
The nauseous okay. feeling. You
the
get.
Nostalgia. The nostalgia.
From
very
the
good.
The humidity. The heat exhaustion. Yep.
Very good. Very good. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more of that when we get to our USC practice observations, which we're going to end with sort of before questions. But you mentioned a five star and the kind of these five star guys when we're talking about our NIL stuff. So that's a good transition to our kind of talking point with Mateo Ugiangale.
God, now you're going to make me say it wrong.
Yeah.
You said it. Ungalale.
I don't know what it is. Like when DJ was at Bosco, I like specifically was like on it. And now that it's Mateo, I don't know why. I just can't. I'm in my own head. I got the yips about it. I can't say it.
The pronunciation is kind of changed. I remember talking to his dad, Dave, back when DJ was a freshman and he was with Winter Circle. And we're like, it might even be Keely, me, and I don't know, maybe it's somebody else. I can't remember. It was like the group of us, and we were at a USC, I think it was a camp, and his dad was kind of talking to us, and he was just like, you know, giving us the pronunciation. And I felt like it was different then. The pronunciation was not Ungalale, but Ungalale is what they're going with on ABC these days and ESPN. And when DJ's playing for Clemson, it's Ungalale. So it's like, all right, it's Ungalale now. So that's what I'm going with.
Okay. Well, this is sort of maybe a time to kind of update USC fans on his recruitment. Obviously, USC has been a big player for him. But Ohio State may be kind of trending in the direction for the big five-star edge out of St. John Bosco.
Yeah, Ohio State has been actually trending for a few weeks now. And that's been more from that side of the country. And, you know, with the recruiting process and official visits and, you know, everybody thinks everybody's getting everybody. It's kind of hard to decipher, you know, what's true and what's just optimism. But I've heard, you know, more recently on this side of the country now that Ohio State is a very big player for Mateo Ungalale. And, you know, USC is not the big leader that a lot of USC sources feel they are. USC, from the people we've spoken to for, you know, really the past 6 months, have been very, very confident that Mateo Ungalale will end up at USC. And I'm not saying that it's not true. It's just from somebody pretty close to the situation that is not a USC fan or a USC booster or Ohio State fan or Ohio State booster or any coach for either program. Somebody pretty objective said that they didn't think he's going to end up at USC. And so that's pretty interesting. That's, again, you know, we've seen this this summer be pretty strange and pretty hard to predict in terms of where guys have ended up. You know, I mean, there's certainly been some guys that USC has got landed as commitments that you would think, you know what, that's probably going to go away from them. And then there's some guys that you thought that they had a really good shot at that ended up going elsewhere. So we'll see how it shakes out. It may not be something that happens here in the near future. We kind of, you know, it's open-ended from everything that we've heard with Mateo Ungulale. But certainly, you know, I think USC still has to be in it. I think, as I said before, with Mateo, I think football is not the end-all be-all for him like it was right. With DJ. I think with DJ, it was about going and winning football games and player development, and that's why he went, you know, to Clemson. I think he also wanted to get away from home too. But if football was definitely a bigger factor for him, I think with Mateo, there's a lot off the field that he's looking at. And so, yeah, you know, it's going to be interesting. I have to sort of check in with some other sources, you know, to kind of see if anything has changed with them. But yeah, pretty good source was not very high on USC's chances right now. Felt like it was Ohio State, maybe even Oregon, USC maybe running third. So something, you know, worth just putting out there. I know it's going to cause chaos and you know, a bunch of Chicken Littles on the message boards. But
yeah, how do you feel about ruining everyone's Friday who listened to this? How do you feel about it? Are you proud of yourself? Proud of yourself, Hurricane?
Again, I mean, it's one source, but it's definitely a source worth, you know, it certainly raised my eyebrow. Like, wow, I have not heard that before. Well, I have. I have, but it's been from, you know, sources that you kind of go, well, okay, they would think that. They would probably have that opinion. This is the first time I've heard it from someone who, like I said, is really doesn't have a dog in the fight in terms of where he goes.
Well, like you said, Mateo has a lot of aspirations kind of off the field, outside of football. That would be young concrete. And again, I just come back to it and like, how could you be young concrete and not see the Dr. Dre school and be like, yeah, this is the place for me. But again, can't look at it logically sometimes, Gerard.
That's us projecting, you know, the sort of checklist that these kids talk about and the things that they've said publicly, like with Josh Connerly Jr. And you sort of project, well, yeah, I mean, it makes sense, but then they do something completely different. So, you know, I don't know. Again, this is not like a prediction or any finality to this. Chris has his own sources as well, and he spends a lot of time at Bosco because he doesn't live very far from Bosco. So, you know, he lives at Bosco. So, I mean, Jason Negro actually got you your job, and you still haven't even bought the guy a beer for it. Like, wow.
First of all, it was a steak dinner.
Your sources are probably really good right now.
It was a steak dinner, and you're right. I absolutely still have to do that. So, shout out to Jason Negro, head coach, St. John Bosco. We still have to get that steak together. Yeah. I'm sorry. I apologize. I profusely apologize. But yes, we'll try to get a more official update from Mateo, the man himself, because I'm sure I'm going to be out at one of their summer practices once again in the near future. In the near future. I guess that's a good way to kind of transition into more defensive line news. You know, Mateo being an edge. USC did have a interesting new offer out in the 2023 class for Caleb Bryant. A three-star defensive lineman, 6'3", 250 pounds, out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. Actually, a Utah commit, been committed since the summer. And this is an interesting offer. They actually gave him the official offer. I think he posted that earlier this morning. But number 506 in the 247 composite, number 60 defensive lineman in the 24/7 composite, number 86 overall defensive lineman in our 247 sports rankings. You know, got power fives from Nebraska, Mississippi State, Miami, Missouri, Oregon has an offer in there. So he has some interesting power five offers, you know, some schools. A lot of them, I guess the early on ones were, you know, HBCUs, Alabama A&M, kind of schools like that were on him. But he's kind of taken a step up as a power five prospect. And, you know, you got to love, you know, Utah's eval of him. Utah puts out some good hard-nosed defensive linemen, so he's good enough for Utah. You know, I think a lot of schools are going to come looking a little bit more at this kid. So Caleb Bryant, new addition to the defensive line board for Sean Nua.
That's a hell of a segue, too, right after talking about Mateo Ungulale. There are going to be some people connecting the dots on that one, Mr.
Look, Tofino. Look, I just read what's on the docket. I just read what's on the docket, Hurricane.
Yeah, Terrence Green says hello. yeah, so 6'3", 250 pounds, defensive lineman. You know, Mateo is about 6'4", probably 260, 270. I have not seen much of Caleb Bryant. I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch his film to see what type of player he is. But Utah from Vicksburg, Mississippi, very, you know, strange sort of commitment there. Took his only official visit during the summer to Utah. So stands to reason, you know, they built a good relationship with him, got him out on that official visit. Didn't really have a lot of Power 5 offers, so he committed to Utah. I don't know what Mississippi State and Mississippi are doing, kind of asleep at the wheel potentially, or maybe they've just evaluated the kid and they know more than Utah does. But very interesting. USC comes in with the scholarship offer as well as Oregon. Oregon followed the next day with a scholarship offer as well. And that's actually where Terrence Green, 6'5", 265-pound defensive end, ended up. Remember, Terrence Green had his visit canceled to USC during the summer. Some interesting moves there where USC felt pretty confident about Grant Buckey. But here we have another defensive line offer, 6'3", 250, similar body types. Again, I haven't really seen Caleb Bryant much on film to really say what type of player he is. Is he an actual hybrid guy? Probably not. He's rated as a defensive lineman, so you're probably not going to see much two-point stance from him. But another guy that's sort of that defensive end interior, which potentially, you know, could put probably 20 pounds, 30 pounds on him, and he'll be 280. So, yeah, kind of an interesting move for USC to offer him a scholarship. I believe one of the new administrators that they brought in is from Mississippi State. So
that's correct.
Potentially, you know, there's some eval there. But to my knowledge, I mean, Mississippi State has not offered Caleb Bryant a scholarship. Am I correct about that, or am I wrong about that?
I believe it says they've offered him.
They've offered him. Okay.
Yeah, it says they offered that.
Okay, so it says he has. Okay, so the full view on his recruitment, which I don't know why this reads this way, but Utah and Nebraska are really the only schools at the very top, and then it's a bunch of like Alabama A&M, Alabama State, Alcorn State. Probably because Utah and Nebraska were the only schools that were actively recruiting him. We've seen this many times where schools offer scholarships to kids and then they don't even talk to them like the next week. It's just, you know, scholarship offers don't really mean a whole lot. There's a lot of kids out there that have Alabama scholarship offers that never spoke to Alabama past, you know, the conversation they had with a position coach, you know, the week they got the scholarship, and never spoke to Nick Saban and never visited, etc. So, I mean, technically, officially, it has on his profile Miami, Mississippi State, Missouri. Let's see, another Power 5 school would be – that's it. That's his Power 5 school. In fact, he didn't even have an offer from Nebraska here, but Nebraska for some reason – well, wait. Nope. Telling a lie. Nebraska is actually listed twice in his profile. Somebody is not paying attention to this profile very well.
I'm sorry. It's probably me. He actually had two crystal balls for the Bulldogs. That was about 2 months before he actually committed to Utah. So,
We're going to have to get some backstory on this kid and sort of what all happened there with his scholarship offers. And he never took an official visit to Mississippi State. So that sort of tells me something, that they were slow playing him probably. And Utah was aggressive. They went out and they got him. So, you know, certainly the local SEC schools could circle the wagons on him. The Oregon offer is new. So certainly they like him and they're, you know, deciding they're going to make a move on him. So we'll see how that develops.
78 tackles last season, 14 tackles for a loss and 11 sacks, 2 forced fumbles. He has 30 tackles for a loss and 20 sacks in his last two seasons. So very productive player. And I guess we could just keep sort of defensive line news rolling, because 2023 Kansas City, Missouri defensive lineman, 4-star prospect Edric Hill actually put USC among his top 6 lists, along with Alabama, LSU, Missouri, Oklahoma and Oregon. So you, Hale did take an official visit to USC this summer. He also took a visit to LSU and Alabama. So sounds like he's winding down in his recruitment. Six on the board, number 187 in the 24/7 Sports composite, number 27 defensive lineman, number 45 defensive lineman in the 24/7 Sports rankings. Alabama has the two crystal ball projections, 6'3", 290-pound defensive lineman out of North Kansas City High School, Edric Hill. And that was sort of felt like a last-minute kind of addition for USC in their summer official visit list.
Yeah, and a guy that is completely off the grid in terms of doing interviews or talking to the media or knowing kind of what's going on with him. I don't know if anybody has actually even spoken to him since he officially visited USC. We tried and we tried and we tried, and I called the kid, but, you know, just doesn't really like to talk very much. And so Alabama's there. He did take a visit to Alabama. I don't know if that was an official visit. I have to look at his profile to see what his official visit doc it really was, what his itinerary was.
It was Alabama, LSU, and USC.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think anybody would pick USC, but again, this is a weird year, man. This is a weird year, weird cycle. NIL is definitely in full effect. And, you know, USC has been able to pluck some guys that a lot of people probably didn't think they were able to get going into the summer. So, like I said, I mean, you know, the way things have been going, they'll lose Alani Noah to Oregon and they'll get Edric Hill, which, you know, I Trojan fans, because they're so focused on that front 12, really. That's where I think most people feel like the class is really going to be win or lost. If you're able to keep Malachi Nelson and you're able to keep Zach Branch, it's really about what you get in that front 12, right? The five offensive linemen and your defensive line and your linebackers. And that's going to be really what wins or loses championships for USC as well, because that's still what championship football is really built on. You know, it's that front 12. If you're able to get good offensive linemen and good defensive linemen and linebackers, everything else kind of sort of falls into place. Now, I would argue, and certainly you've got to have some elite quarterback. You got to have a good quarterback. Elite, I surely helps. I mean, the teams that have won the big games here and won playoff games recently have certainly had great quarterback play. So, you know, there have been schools in the past that have had, you know, more like, you know, Colt McCoy types that are maybe not the big time first round picks. I don't know. Where did Colt McCoy go in the draft? He actually was drafted.
I feel like he was a fourth round kind of pick.
He was, for me, he was like a Cody Kessler type. He wasn't the guy, you know. He wasn't going to be a Vince Young type. He wasn't going to be, of course, not an Archie Manning type. I mean, gosh, no way it could be at that level. But nevertheless, I still think, yeah, you got to get your quarterback, which is easy for USC. Most years, it's going to be a local kid. And there's probably going to be two or three of them locally. They're going to be five-star level guys. I mean, if there's one thing California still produces plenty of, it's good quarterbacks. So, you know, that's not like you have to really go across the country to go grab a quarterback. It's really about that front 12 and those offensive linemen and defensive linemen. So it would be interesting to see if you pulled the peristyle. Who would you rather have, Alani Noah or Edric Hill? I think most people would say Edric Hill, but just because it's harder to find
right
defensive linemen. You know, now what would I bet on USC getting? I'd still have to go with, you know, the common logical sort of, you know, what we've been able to scrap through sources and everything and say, oh, they're going to get Alani Noah. They're not going to get Edric Hill. But nevertheless, you know, maybe, you know, not, you know, Boulevard and everything sort of up and running and going and there being some momentum. Maybe they get both.
Colt McCoy, third round pick, number 85 overall. So there you go.
Since the playoff era, I feel like most of these schools have needed to have elite quarterback play to win those games. I mean, I'm thinking of Tui Tagovailoa,
Bryce Young,
Trevor Lawrence, Bryce Young. Now, but you know what? Gosh, I say that, completely contradict myself. Who?
Stenson Bennett?
Quarterback? Yeah, who was Georgia's quarterback last year? I was thinking they got JT Daniels at Georgia, but JT Daniels didn't really even play. Yeah, so Yeah, you know, you can still have a manager at quarterback if you have a great defense. You know, the Georgia defense was generational. I mean, it was one of the best defenses we've seen in college football in a while. So, yeah, I mean, you know, most of those teams have had some first-round quarterbacks, though. You know, even going back to LSU winning the championship, all those teams have had elite quarterback play. So that seems to be, you know, the best thing. But certainly – you know, that front 12 is also just as important. It's just as important because you can have an elite quarterback and a very average offensive line and an average defensive line. And guess what? You're not even going to get to the college football playoff. You're not even win your conference if that's the case. So, yeah, I think that's sort of the formula for USC. And, you know, they've had some success here. They've got a little momentum here. And if they're able to continue to build toward that magical number 18 number that I put out there after I put a number 20 number out there and had to back off of that. It's going to be mostly with the front, you know, 12 players.
Shout out to Stenson Bennett for blowing up Gerard's take right there.
I know.
I appreciate it.
I was thinking, and JT Daniels is not even there anymore. He's at West Virginia. So
West Virginia, y'all.
Yeah. The quarterback, conversation with Bryce Young and all these other guys you think about, you just think about the quarterback position. You know, you forget the guy that's not the first round pick at quarterback.
Okay, so I think we're going to use this time to take our break. When we come back, we're going to get into the Hurricanes observations from the Coliseum practice we both attended. And then we got a laundry list of questions to handle. How's that sound, Gerard?
That sounds scary.
It's okay. We'll get through it together. So we'll be right back after this break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Gerard, you know what I'm going to ask.
And you know what I'm going to say.
Yep. So let's just move on. Let's not even do it. Let's not even do this whole bit. Let's just keep it rolling.
Let's talk about the Coliseum observation practice notes and analysis that we have for our 15 minutes of practice view.
You ready for the boom? Hurricane.
So obviously I cover every USC practice. So I talk about practice and what I see at practice a lot, whether that's on tunnel vision or on instant analysis nowadays. But I'm sure people are tired of hearing about what I think about practice. And I know everyone listening probably cares about what Gerard thought about practice, what he saw at practice, because Gerard doesn't always get to talk like actual like USC football, you know. Mainly people rely on him for recruiting and stuff. But obviously, Gerard knows his shit. And people like to hear when he talks about the team. And you always do really good tweet analysis during games, pointing stuff out. So always like retweeting those. But Gerard, I'm curious about what you thought about practice and kind of what you saw from our limited observations about what you saw from, I guess, intensity or the structure or just, you know, general newcomers in general. I said that twice. I just really fumbled that. But Gerard, just tell me, what did you think of practice, the night Coliseum practice that we got to see?
Yeah, it was limited.
Yes, it was. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. It was limited, and I can't see myself making any grand predictions about the season. Just really haven't really seen the team very much. You know, that spring football showcase was really the most that we'd seen from the team, and what we're seeing now is warmups, some individual work, and that's about it. You know, we're not seeing any sort of 7-on, we're not seeing any 11-on-11 in terms of intensity, in terms of the physicality of practices. You're not seeing any of that stuff, so I can't make any type of observation or try to analyze or evaluate how the team has improved or is distinctly different from years past. I know everybody talks about the cultural change. You know, we'll see that happen during the season. I don't just, you know, go, oh, wow. So, you know, the players say it's so different and just think, well, it must be different. You know, I mean, players always talk about energy and they talk about things and what have you. But the proof, as they say, is in the pudding. And that's in wins and losses and how teams respond and how they play during the season. So we'll see how competitive they are and, you know, not just in the games they win, but, you know, any games they lose. You know, how close those games are, how they lose those games. We're really going to have to wait until the season to really know, because we just have not seen anything from practice that can that you can build, I think, a case on. Perhaps maybe there's a scrimmage that pops up and they open it up a little more. We get to see what happens. But they've been extremely, extremely paranoid about having anybody say and see anything or what have you, or be around during a period. I mean, it's kind of overboard at this point, especially coming from somebody who covered USC back when they were winning national championships almost three in a row, and any Tom, Dick, and Harry could come off the street and watch practice, all practice. So this is the antithesis of that, the exact opposite of, you know, what we had back in the Pete Carroll era. So in terms of observations, just some small things that I saw from some of the players. You know, I'm always interested in seeing the newcomers and how they transition and how they adapt, you know, into that team structure. And there's, you know, a lot of newcomers, some guys there, obviously they were doing spring, but just a completely different team than last year. And Jordan Addison is one of the biggest newcomers that was not there during the spring. And just watching him run routes, he's very fluid. He has great reach for a guy his size. He's not a very tall receiver. I mean, he's about 6 foot, but he really has that ability to give you a really big window as a quarterback. And you can just see how easy it is to throw to him. You know, the way he runs routes, how smooth, how consistent he is. He glides, and it's very easy to throw to him. Now, again, we didn't see a lot of one-on-ones or anything to see, you know, how he got open. How intricate he was with his route running.
We didn't see any one-on-ones, Troy.
Yeah, we didn't see any. We didn't see any, you know, how he blocks in the run game, etc. Definitely showed just against air. And USC will see some air during the season. They're not going to play much against it, but they'll see some air. He was very comfortable, it looked like. And I could see why he's a guy that the quarterbacks want to throw to. It just seems like he gives himself a very good window for quarterbacks to be able to throw to. So I thought, you know, he was interesting. We saw Relique Brown, freshman running back / receiver, going through some passing drills. I think what looking at him physically right now and seeing how he's developed his upper body quite a bit. You know, he's always had a good bit of lower body explosion and lower body strength, but he looks like a running back now. He does not look like DeAnthony Thomas, right? DeAnthony Thomas, they put at running back, but they put a lot at receiver too because they didn't want him to take a pounding at running back because he was very diminutive. He was very small. He was very slight. He was like 165, I think, when he arrived at Oregon. And I don't think he was probably above 200 pounds when he left. Relique Brown's not built like that. Relique Brown is stocky. He is small.
He's got he's got some arms.
Yeah.
I posted a video.
That's where he's developed. That his upper body strength has been 100% where he's developed. He's always had, again, you know, a good lower body, a good foundation on him as a running back. But yeah, man, he's got arms now and he's stronger looking. And to me, I just don't picture him playing a lot of receiver. I was going to ask that of Lincoln Riley, but we didn't get enough time in terms of the vision for him and how he was recruited. He was recruited during the recruiting process when Lincoln Riley was at Oklahoma as a slot receiver, first and foremost. They sold him on that. And then when they came to USC, it was kind of sort of the same thing. But I think he's a running back. I think he's a guy that can certainly catch the ball in the backfield. He's got good hands, and he's comfortable out there. But this is a guy that's an explosive running back, and USC needs to have some depth at running back. And so I think he's going to get a majority of his reps at running back. Also at receiver, we saw a little C.J. Williams, and he looked really good. He looks he just looks ready to go. Like, he looks like physically he's going to be able to contribute this year. I don't know, you know, it's a stack position. I don't know where he's going to find those reps, but he looks like a guy that is ready to make an impact, runs really good routes, really a smart kid, strong, a possession receiver, but has a little bit of burst once he catches the ball. And so I like the way he looked. He looked just very decisive in his route running and catching the football, and certainly a player that USC is going to need in the future as they have some of these upperclassmen leave, guys like Jordan Addison. Devin Tompkins, a guy that we saw during the summer at the camps.
I'm big on the Devin Tompkins train right now.
Yeah, who physically is just Devin Tompkins now look like he ate Devin Tompkins from last spring.
Yeah,
he's got to be 250, 260 now, and he looks like he's going to be a three technique. He's 6'6", probably 250, 260. And is a guy that don't waste your time having him stand up at the line of scrimmage and play around like, oh, which gap am I going to go to? I'm going to confuse the offense. Ooh. No, just put him at three technique. Well, right now he's probably a five technique, but I think you eventually want to put him as a three technique, put that weight on him, get him to 285, and let him go ham right in that A gap. That's I think, where Devin Tompkins is going to be a player for USC. And certainly – I mean, he's put on a ton of weight, and it just looks like good weight, and it looks like he's going to be able to put on more.
Yeah, it looks like he can definitely hold more to that frame. And I hope it's not a situation, like you said, you don't want him to necessarily stand him up. I hope it's not a situation like with Solomon Bird. Solomon Bird, the Wyoming transfer, started out playing defensive end, and now they're just playing him at rush end to start fall because they want him to learn both spots. I hope Devin didn't start out learning rush end, and now he's learning defensive line. I think he's just by the look of him, like you said, just keep him on that D line. Don't try to stand him up.
Yeah, I didn't get to see a lot of Bird, but that's another guy that watching him at Wyoming, I think you want to put him on his hand on the ground. You know, I don't know if you want to get real cute. And, you know, with Corey Foreman, and obviously there's a lot of questions about Corey Foreman right now because he hasn't been practicing. A lot of people are nervous about him. They are expecting big things from him. And I think, you know, that goes to sort of a bigger conversation about five-star guys, recruiting them, developing them, and how that impacts the recruiting process. With Imam Marshall, USC really, they were hurt in recruiting because Imam Marshall did not develop at USC and become a first round pick the way everybody thought he was going to. And that perception, it impacts your ability to recruit in the future. Now, you know, guys can be busts. Guys can just be overrated. But nevertheless, from a perception standpoint, it's going to be ammo for other schools to use against you. If you recruit a bunch of busts, it's going to hurt you. It doesn't matter if those guys just end up really being busts. I mean, hey, at the end of the day, if he's a bust, then it was a bad evaluation by your coaching staff. Right. So it hurts you recruiting either way. And Imam Marshall, not just that he didn't go in the first round, but the fact that he wasn't a three and out was a big deal to people. I remember hearing that several times over the course of him being at USC, and it's like, yeah, look at USC. They don't have to develop anybody. Look at Amon Marshall. Amon Marshall was a generational player at cornerback, and he's not even like he can't even get out early to go to the NFL. That hurt USC in the recruiting process. And so they got to get Corey Foreman up and running and develop him to make some plays, because if he ends up being a guy that transfers out, it's going to hurt USC. Even though this is not the coaching staff that recruited him, it doesn't matter, man. That's just the way recruiting goes. It's going to be a black eye on your player development. And so you want to see Corey Foreman get out there. He played, obviously, in a different system last year. I felt like he had more of the athleticism and the traits to allow him to be a hybrid guy. But I do sort of wonder if he's still in that sort of no man's land of learning two positions and doing two different things. And if it would just be better for him to put his hand on the ground, go get the quarterback, go be a pass rusher, young man, and focus on that. And don't worry about standing up and going through, you know, drills of taking running backs out of the backfield and things of that nature, because there's some guys that can do it. And again, go back to the top of the show. Braylon Shelby is that guy. He can do it. You're not going to have to worry about him. He has the spatial awareness, instincts, agility, balance and speed, eyes, all those things to do that. But some guys don't. And Corey Foreman coming out of high school had a little bit of that, right? Drake Jackson really didn't have any of it, to be perfectly honest. He never did that in high school. He was a defensive lineman. He was a pass rusher in high school. You know, it was USC's convoluted idea to put him at linebacker. And not just USC, it was his idea as well. I mean, to be fair, he loved that idea. He was sold on that idea. Oh, being a USC linebacker, you know, maybe wearing number 55, all that stuff. But again, that's sort of like, you know, you have to be strong as a coaching staff and have a strong philosophy and say, no, listen, this is what's best for you. You need to buy into this because this is ultimately what's going to work for you. You know, that was one of the issues, you know, bigger picture with Clay Helton, is that he kind of just sort of went with whatever, you know, the players wanted. He was a player's coach too much. Like it went to the too far into the, you know, what's the saying? It's the inmates are running the asylum. That kind of became a little bit of what Coach Helton's legacy was, and why, you know, so many players really liked him, because they gave in too much to what the players liked. It has to be at some point, listen, we're working with you, but you're a player. You're not a coach. You don't know what's the best for you necessarily. You know, you know where you feel comfortable and you have these ideals in your head of what you could be, but I'm here to give you the realistic view, the realistic evaluation of what you can be. That's my strength. That's why I'm a coach. That's why they pay me money to do what I do. So let me direct you. You know, it's like it's like actors directing themselves on film. It's like that doesn't work. You need a director. You need somebody paid to direct them. Well, that's what the coaches are supposed to do from an evaluation standpoint. And evaluating and self-evaluating your own roster is just as important as evaluating, you know, recruits. So I think with Corey Foreman, there's got to be an evaluation there of saying, okay, what are his actual strengths? And we need to bolster those before we get into these other things he can kind of do to throw wrinkles into our scheme and things. It's like, it's great to have that, but you don't necessarily want to build on those right out of the gates. Let's get Corey Foreman, you know, getting to practice consistently, getting reps consistently, staying healthy and on the field at one position, doing one thing first, and then we can build on some other things.
Well said. A nice take by Gerard. There are some like sort of like small changes with some guys. I was wondering if I could just throw them out and get your reaction.
Yeah, sure.
Julian Simon, sort of inside linebacker, has been working rush end as a position we were just talking about, which I find interesting just because Julian, while he does have really good athleticism, you know, he was recruited as a tight end and a running back for some schools before settling on linebacker for the Trojans. He doesn't have a ton of length. He's only like 6'1", maybe 6'2". But I just thought that was an interesting switch for him to go to kick from outside to that rush end spot. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't think he has enough length to play at the line of scrimmage against offensive tackles. You know, maybe as a Sam linebacker, if you were putting him off the line of scrimmage and you just had him matching up against tight ends and reading tight ends and basically playing at the line of scrimmage for that, maybe. But yeah, I don't know that's going to go very far. He's not very big to be able to tangle with people at the line of scrimmage. So yeah, that's an interesting move.
Another one isn't a position switch, but just someone who has been sort of running with the ones consistently is Sia Wright. You know, he, a former top 100 prospect, he has been the guy early in fall camp opposite of Mekhi Blackmon for that second cornerback spot. And that's kind of where he ended spring camp. There were some injuries, so him, Prophet Brown, were kind of thrust into those two starting spots late in spring camp. They started the spring game. There were some ups and downs with that. But I picked Josh Jackson coming back from injury to kind of be the guy who wins that other job. But lo and behold, we have Sierre, the true sophomore. Is he a true sophomore? I don't believe he is a true sophomore. But, you know.
Eligibility-wise, he's still a freshman.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's kind of hard because it's like USC labels them as if there's not a COVID waiver, but then we know that there's that COVID year still. So, like, for us on the site, I think how Ryan does it is this is the eligibility they have. So we're including the COVID year in their eligibility because, yes, you would have to technically get a waiver for it, but it's everybody gets it. It's not like a medical redshirt where, you know, you have petitioned for that waiver and maybe you get it, maybe you don't. Everybody gets it. So USC, I think, labels them from if the, you know, COVID, the COVID year's not there. Whereas I think Ryan puts it down as, you know, this is where their eligibility lies. So with Sierre, he's technically still a freshman eligibility wise.
But yes, in general, just him sort of, you know, on track, on pace, early pace to kind of maybe be a starter this year.
That's interesting. I mean, we just have not seen a whole lot from him. Obviously he's got, you know, some really good length and speed there. He's, sort of Kerry Harris-ish, you know, if you're looking for a comparison in terms of his build and the speed. I don't know if he has the physicality that Kerry Harris had. Kerry Harris was kind of surprisingly physical for how big he was. He was a guy that could come up and smack you pretty good. I've seen that from Sierra at Loyola when he was coming out of high school, but he definitely has, you know, sub-10-8 speed. He's, you know, legit 6'1". Long arms, a guy that was pretty quiet, I think, you know, last year, despite, you know, injuries and you know, trying to see if there would be some rotation there. Didn't really get in very much. So it's good to hear that, you know, he's involved and that, you know, he potentially could live up to the billing. I mean, like I just said with Corey Foreman, you know, that goes across the board with all these players. You know, you've got highly rated players. You got to get those highly rated players out. And they still need to be highly rated, you know, when they're going out of college, or else, you know, that's going to be what's going to hurt your player development. It's going to hurt you on the recruiting trail. But yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see also what happens with Jacoby Covington. You know, that's another guy that comes in that I think you expect to compete for a starting job potentially. Josh Jackson as well was a guy that came in and. You know, originally as a receiver, has great ball skills and just sort of slid over there at the beginning of the season to cornerback. And, you know, they really liked his length. And Dante Williams was very complimentary of him. And not, you know, not terribly different, like, physically from Sierra Wright in terms of his build. You know, he's another kind of lean, sort of 6-foot-ish, long arms, really good ball skills, not necessarily the most physical cornerback, but a guy that, you know, can certainly do a lot from a skill set standpoint. Mekhi Blackmon is, you know, interesting. I'm not completely sold on him. Everybody sort of just pencils him in at that other cornerback spot. I'm interested to see how well he plays if they're not just sort of like, you know, giving him that spot because he has seniority. I mean, he is the senior of that group. He is the guy that's got the most experience, certainly. At Colorado, I thought he was okay. I didn't think he was, you know, necessarily like a lockdown guy that's like, oh, my gosh, you know, he's a guy that is going to come into USC and he's just, you know, going to be the starter automatically. I think Christian Gonzalez was the better of the two. Christian Gonzalez ended up transferring to Oregon. So I'm interested to see if Jacoby Covington can make a push and actually play cornerback. Jalen Smith is still, I think, even listed as a cornerback, but is more of a safety. He's more of a nickel safety than anything. And obviously, Max Williams is sort of similar in that role.
And just final one, not necessarily like an earth shattering kind of switch, but Mason Murphy, who has been mainly a left tackle, kind of taking left tackle right reps, the second team left tackle for most of his time before he was hurt last year, has now started sort of cross training and playing a right tackle spot and possibly even moving in to play a little interior just to get some experience there in fall camp.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think he's, you know, potentially if he's able to get to the next level, might be a bit more of a guard. I don't know if he has the athleticism to be a flat-out tackle. But I think, you know, at the college level, he certainly can get away with right tackle. We've seen him bounce around a little bit, but left tackle's tough, man. You know, there's a reason why those guys are so coveted. You have to have a real kind of specific skill set to go against some of these real speed rushers. I mean, some of these guys are like bats out of hell. You get guys that run in, you know, a 4.5, 4.6 range, and you're a 310-pound lineman. You got to have a lot of length, and you got to have really good quick feet, good balance. So, I mean, that stands to reason. I think you definitely want any of your linemen that are not like a franchise guy at a specific position. You know, that's his position. He owns that position. He's been dominant at the position. Any of those guys, you move them around because you're going to have injuries on the offensive line, and you got to have some versatility. And some of those guys are able to make a name and make a push into the next level because of that versatility. I mean, you look at Elijah Vera Tucker. Elijah Vera Tucker would have been, you know, a pretty highly drafted guard, but he would have probably been in the third round, fourth round. But he showed the versatility of being able to play offensive tackle, not just offensive tackle, but left tackle. That's huge. Now, is he going to be a franchise left tackle? Probably not. But he could end up being a franchise offensive lineman somewhere else because he showed that versatility, showed the ability as an interior guy to go out there on an island and play left tackle. So that's huge. That's something that, you know, everybody covets. And being smart enough and being versatile enough to go inside, outside, to play different positions. I think one thing that we talked about when we were watching practice is USC going through a litany of different centers. I think that's interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that that Josh Henson spoke on a little bit, looking for, you know, a specific skill set to play center. And those guys are important to get. And that's interesting because, you know, they've used some different guys at that position. We've seen Gino Quinones play some center in the past. I think Andrew Melick is playing center now.
Cooper Lovelace is getting some work at center. So they're getting a lot of guys that work at center.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I talked about this with Micah Benuelos being committed. You know, that's a little underrated position. You know, the guy's handling the ball every snap and has to make these calls, has to be a quarterback of sorts. And there's physically some things that you want to see from your centers that you may not need from your guards. So that's a really kind of underrated position that, you know, right now USC's tinkering with different body types and some different players. And certainly those guys that they're using right now that they have playing center, one sort of looks a lot like Micah Benuelos, and that's Brett Nealon, right? You know, Justin Dedich, who played a bunch of center and now is playing guard, is a guy that actually played center in high school, but I think is probably a little more like Benuelos. Whereas you look at a guy like Andrew Melick, who is an offensive tackle in high school. Gino was a defensive lineman mostly in high school at St. Louis. So, you know, you have a lot of different type of body types. I think USC is just kind of trying to get a feel for, you know, what they have and who can do what, and guys that maybe just don't fit a specific position right away.
And Hurricane, that's all the sort of things I wanted to get your opinion on. Unless there's anything else you want to talk about practice, I think it's time to move on to questions.
Evidently, we got a lot of questions, so let's try to tackle some of these questions.
We do got a lot of questions. Normally, we would have like 6 or 7 questions. Today, we have like one person sent in 5 questions himself. So this is going to be a long list. So let's try to hit these as hard as we can. And if you are interested in sending us a question, to get answered on the podcast, you can email us at podcast@uscfootball.com. Just make sure you put the composite or Cilantro Boys or Hurricane or 10K, the Latino guys, whatever you want, just to identify us so it'll get to us and go into my inbox. You can also DM me a question. Do not DM Gerard because he will not see it, and his DMs aren't even open, so it's just a losing battle there. So, Gerard, let's get into it. First one is DM from Can He Live? Since a Texas kid as big, fluid, and prototypical for a key position as Braylon Shelby seems to. Okay, I gotta self-correct here. Since a Texas kid is big, fluid, and prototypical for a key position as Braylon Shelby seems to not be a five-star, what qualifies someone to be a five-star prospect?
That is not a question for me. That's a question for Greg Biggins or Steve Whitlong or the guys that to do the committee on rankings.
Right. So just very quickly, the kind of the five-star and – right. Gerard – any of those guys Gerard listed will have a better answer, a more detailed answer. But all the rankings are sort of based off of NFL draft potential. That's why there's 32 five stars every year for the composite or for the 247 rankings, because it mimics or reflects the 32 picks in the NFL first round or an NFL team. So that's sort of where the kind of rankings. That's kind of what they have in mind when they're kind of distinguishing five-star between four-star, three-star. It's kind of based on sort of NFL potential. And a five-star is sort of you have the potential to be a first-round draft pick. Those are the kind of measurables that you have. That's only why there's only 32 in any given cycle. So, you know, Shelby has a lot of intangibles and measurables that you like. So, and again, it's only the summer. So with the big senior season, this guy can move up significantly. And I think he will move up. Will he get to five-star status? I don't know. You know, he looks good on tape, looks good in person if you ever see him. So I think he has the potential to move up a lot more. But kind of with five stars, it's kind of based off NFL draft potential. Next one comes from Neil. Thank you. Hey, guys, if signing day was today, who would you both predict to commit for the 2023 class that hasn't officially committed yet? Again, this comes from Neil in Inglewood. So obviously there's a lot of names we could say, but I'm not going to go through. I don't want to go through a whole list to fill out a full class or anything like that, but just names. I would say probably Deuce Robinson is a name that I'll throw out there. Gerard, do you want to throw out a name? I'm stalling.
We would think that Alani Noah would be in there.
Yeah.
You know, up until just recently, I would have said Mateo Ungalale would be a guy that I would earmark as a guy that would be potentially part of the USC class. Although, you know, hearing that maybe that's not going to be the case. Doing a whole like prediction list right now and we're still trying to get out of the summer is completely futile. We still have to see what happens with Malachi Nelson potentially visiting some other schools. There are guys that are committed that may look at other schools if USC craps down the side of their leg this season. I mean, that's just the long and short of it.
What a beautiful metaphor.
Well, you know what? I will actually give Craig Kniver credit for that, because he told me that last season about recruiting and about some things. And that was what he said. I said, you know what? That's exactly what it is, man. That's exactly what it is. If you don't get it done during the season and you you play bad and you lose games, it's just you're spinning your wheels on some of those kids. They're just going to go elsewhere. Now, again, you know, the NIL thing is a wild card to some extent. We saw with Texas A&M last year, they didn't have like a great year, but they did beat Alabama, and I think they built a lot on see what we can do. We just get better players. We can build other players. We can build and beat other teams that are at that level. We can play at that level. We just, you know, injuries, whatever, you know, they're just salesmen. You just coaching staff's just selling it. Jimbo's out there and he's selling it. And the kids bought into it, and the NIL and the collective thing was working for them as well. So, you know, Are schools that are 7-5, is that it's still going to be one of those things where you can still be a completely mediocre program and end up with, you know, one of the best recruiting classes in the past 10 years? Is that going to be like the norm? We don't know. We don't know. I would bet against it. I think A&M just got ahead of the curve with things. They were ultra aggressive and able to sort of script the line of some things potentially. And that got them a great class. And so I don't know that Miami's going to be able to do that this year, or Tennessee, schools that you don't necessarily predict are going to have great seasons, but have really good recruiting classes and continue to seem to have a lot of momentum on the recruiting trail. So with USC, I think they got to win games. Okay. They got to win games, and you got to get into that 9-10 game wins to be able to maybe flip some guys and hold on to your best recruits. So yeah, we'll get there. Making predictions now is just, it's silly.
This next one comes from Kevin. Hey, Chris, fellow P member, I have a question. When is the next recruiting event? Now that the collective has been announced, you think we see the effects right away? Well, the collective won't go into effect in 2023, so I don't think so. We're definitely not going to see any of those effects, obviously, this year. And for the next recruiting event, I believe we are on a dead period of some sort. I believe so.
The next recruiting event you'll see at USC is the home opener.
Right. It'll be game days essentially, and they'll bring guys in for practices, fall practices if they're not, you know, swamped with high school ball. We'll see occasionally a couple guys come through, but the big things will obviously be Saturday game days. That's when we'll see kids on the sideline and stuff. Even though that's technically not like a barbecue or anything, like a specific recruiting event, but there will
if
be
you're talking about a recruiting event like a junior day or something of that nature. Yeah, that's not going to happen until January, probably at the earliest February. You're going to see official visits during the season. First official visit I think they have is with Malachi Coleman, which I'm not sure if is that for the home opener or that the following week. I can't remember off the top of my head. I have to pull up his profile, but he's coming in September. So you will have, those are recruiting events. Obviously you have an unofficial visits. They may have something at the end of the year where you have like a group of unofficial visitors that you bring down right before signing day. They had that last year. That was mainly because Lincoln Riley was trying to hit the ground running and he got hired, and it was like, hey, we got to try to get as many as these 2023 guys on campus as possible, get some 2022 guys on campus to try to close strong. And obviously that didn't really work. They could still have something, but normally, the normal process, the normal cycle, you're going to have your official visitors. You'll have a bigger official visit weekend, most likely for the Notre Dame game, the home game this season. And then you will parlay that into, in-home visits. You know, you're going to have your staff on the road, going in and having in-home visits. And then you'll have I think there's 2 weeks there where you can have official visits before the early signing period. So it'll be a more normal year and cycle for USC from that standpoint. You might have maybe some coaches coming or going still, but nevertheless, it will be pretty straightforward. It's not going to be quite as spastic and chaotic because, you know, you hired a coach and you're trying to you know, keep some guys committed and you're trying to get more commits without having really had an established relationship of that class, of that coach with that school.
Next question comes from Kel. Chris and Gerard, with USC's move to the Big Ten, I'm looking forward to not having to worry about Pac-12 officials compromising games. I honestly believe that they cost USC games with regularity. Pete Carroll once offered the conference a study that showed when USC played a Pac-12 game, they were the most penalized team in the country, and when they played non-conference, they were middle of the pack in terms of penalties. What are your thoughts about how USC will fare penalty-wise with clearly more competent officiating crews? Thanks, and fight on. Again, that's from Kel.
If I recall, I think that study actually showed that USC was not only the most penalized team, but the team that they played was like the least penalized team that week, too. It was really bad. It was actually mathematically an impossibility for that not to be something that was manipulated, I guess, was the overarching point about it. And, you know, the conference said something like, oh, yeah, we'll look into it, blah, blah, blah. The officiating Has not been great in the Pac-12 in general. And I think it's definitely been much better in the Big Ten. Now, how that, you know, correlates with wins and losses in terms of where USC ranks. It was interesting because Lincoln Riley did make a comment about penalties.
Yeah. I thought that was a very interesting comment that he made in terms of if you don't have a lot of penalties as a team, you're probably not very good. Because when you play the game of football, and if you play the game of football right, there needs to be an underlying expression of aggression. It's an aggressive sport. You need to have that element in the way you play, and the penalties they don't want are obviously dead ball penalties, you know, administrative penalties, you know, things after the whistle. Those are the ones you can't have. But if you get stuff like holding calls and stuff like that, you know, that's part of the game if you're going out there and being aggressive. So I thought it was interesting, you know, answer to him about penalties, and they did have a lot in their first team period for the Coliseum practice.
Here's an interesting kind of like a story that sort of backs that up. And like
story goes, time, let's go.
Goes back to my young years in football and learning and being coached. I remember the first practice that I ever had in Pop Warner. One of the drills that they made us do, we were running 10 yards. Only 10 yards back and forth. And the drill was a cadence drill. So they would say it's on two whistles, you go. The thing was, you had, if you blew the cadence, right? And say you went on one and it was on two, you had to go. You had to go all the way to the 10 yard line, right? You had to run. If you hesitated, if you jumped, but then you kind of try to pretend like you didn't jump, or you kind of jumped and you went back, the whole team would have to run around the field.
Interesting, interesting.
What that was to do was to reinforce decisiveness in football. Do whatever you're doing full speed, 100%. Do not hesitate out there. If you screw up going 100 miles per hour. Do not screw up going, you know, 30 miles an hour. Don't hesitate. Go full, just be decisive. And that's what the game of football is. The teams that are good are decisive. And if you're going to screw up full speed, be aggressive, be physical. So, yeah, I totally 100% agree with that. I think he's right about that. I think obviously you don't want to be, you know, like crazy penalized and do all kinds of things that kill drives, because college football, you know, jumping off sides and stuff like that can just kill a drive. It just can kill you. So, you know, you do have a quarterback now, though. However, we'll go back to that whole, you know, having a quarterback that can actually make some plays on his own, like Sam Darnold with USC decided to get away from for some reason, can help a lot in that department. But, yeah, at the end of the day, you really don't want to kill drives with penalties. But at the same time, especially on defense, you just want to go out there and you want your guys to play and you play hard. And you're not, if you're thinking, you're hesitating and you're unsure of yourself, that is going to hurt you more than it's going to help you.
What a great little drill. I wish we could see that with the USC players, but that's probably like a too advanced of a drill for college players to do. That's a perfect like Pop Warner kind of drill, but I would still love to see
too
it.
Too advanced? What do you mean not advanced enough? What do you mean too advanced? It wouldn't be too advanced for college players.
Not advanced. I meant like too simplified.
Okay, that's too, what you meant. You meant the opposite of what you said. All right.
Yeah, I meant the opposite of what. We're at the end of the show, man. Give me a break.
It was weird because, I mean, you know, you're a kid and I'm like, I don't know how old I was, 7, 8 years old. And I'm just like, they want you to jump off sides? Like, I don't understand what it meant, but that's what it was. It was like, hey, if you're going to jump all the way to the other line. Like, you go to that other 10 yard line and it's fine. Hey, you're over there and the rest of the team, that's fine. You just wait for them to go and we'll keep on with the drill. And that's all you got to run. But the moment you jump and you try to go back, oh, everybody's taking a lap.
Do you remember if you were good at that or not, or did you like?
I remember that I screwed up. I once, and then other people screwed up also, and we all ran. I remember that, but I don't remember. I didn't. We only did it a few times, like very early on, and I don't. I never screwed up. I never jumped and actually ended up on the other line. No, where it was like that. No.
Okay. Fair enough. Next one comes from TC, dear Chris and Gerard, aka the Cilantro Boys, aka the Menudo Men, aka the Jalapeno Homies, aka the Champion Cholos. Could you provide some insight into Corey Foreman's development on the team and share expectations you have for him in year two? Also, which of the 2023 class do you think is most likely to decommit? thanks for the work you do. Viva la raza from TC. Well, TC, I hope if you were listening for the entirety of podcast, you heard Gerard break down kind of Corey Foreman's development on a lot of it in one of our earlier segments. So hopefully that kind of answered that question. But in terms of expectations, I don't expect him to start this season. I expect him to be Romello Height's job. Seems like he is the clear front runner for that Russian spot. And I expect Corey to be his sort of rotational backup. Kind of based off the spring game rotation, it seemed like Romello and Corey were kind of like a 1A, kind of 1B kind of deal, with Corey getting a lot of rotation. You know, you can put Corey at defensive end, keep Romello at the rush end. So I expect him to kind of get sort of play like that. But I don't expect him to have sort of the pressure of being the starter. That will fall more on Romello, and I think that can loosen him up a little bit, you know, ease that pressure. And in terms of, like, statistics, I think he could get to kind of double what he had last year. I think he kind of had 3.5 or 4.5. But I'm kind of thinking he can come away with, you know, maybe 7-8 sacks, depending on a good year, you know, get some garbage time, rack up some there. So I would expect – I think 8 sacks would be kind of a good year two for him, and sort of, you know, kind of moving into a starter's role probably for his junior year. That's kind of what my thought is on that. Gerard, I know you already talked about the development, but I don't know if you have any certain expectations for that year two season for Corey.
Yeah, I think 8 sacks would be phenomenal for him. I think
certainly doable. Certainly doable.
It'll be interesting to see how much he can play opposite of Romello Height. I think that's going to be an interesting, you know, because, you know, Nick Figueroa is also there, and Nick has been very productive for USC, but then he's also kind of battled injuries here lately, and as Corey has. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, there's plenty of opportunity to get your foot in the door because somebody could go down for a couple games. It's not necessarily like you've got a lot of Iron Men on that defensive front. I mean, that goes even for, you know, Brandon Peely. Like, everybody across the board outside of Thule has had some injuries that have kept them out multiple games. So that's a position where you can definitely rotate also, and you can have guys, especially playing against, you know, a lot of pass-happy offenses in the Pac-12, and they want to run up and down the field. You're going to have some rotation. You know, you're going to have guys that are pass rushers that, you know, have the cardio that can just keep going out there and pushing hard. So it's not a bad thing to have depth at that position. And certainly that is a position where USC has recruited, you know, fairly well at, and has had some depth. It's just a matter of trying to get some production at that position as well. I would like to see just, you know, maybe less moving around though, you know, and try to get guys. I think some of it, you know, it helps nowadays when you've got the transfer portal and you don't want guys to get unhappy, to sort of move them around and give them spots and they can maybe, you know, fit in where they get in. But you also want them to just kind of focus and get better at a single position as well. And that's sort of, you know, my gripe about Thule and seeing him out there standing up in a 2-point stance and rushing the passer sort of as a 5 technique. It's just like, man, that guy is a 3 technique. Put him at defensive line at the 3 technique, and just let him attack the quarterback there. That's what he needs to be doing. You almost need to build your defensive line around that, and then hope one of these guys at the edge can stay healthy and be a counter to that. And so, we'll see how he develops. I have really no expectations. I think what Chris said is exactly, you know, how it stands today. But I wouldn't mind seeing him a little bit opposite of Romello as well, and see, you know, what USC could get out of that.
And in terms of, like, a decommitment pick, I don't really like to do decommitment picks like that, so I'd probably steer away from that, because I don't want to just, like, throw out a decommitment and just
there's nobody right now in this class that are like a Quay Davis, you know, the former commitment at USC. It was a 4-star out of Dallas, and it was like, dude, this guy is not going to end up at USC, and trying to hint at it every which way. But I would say, I mean, just at face value, you kind of look at the two running backs out of Texas, and both of them
I was going to say the running backs too. Those were kind of my guess.
They've gotten some bumps here, and you know, you could see maybe those SEC schools or those Texas schools taking another run at them, especially if Reuben Foster remains committed to Louisville, the 5-star running back, number one running back,
Reuben Owens.
Ruben Owens. What did I say? Ruben Foster. Sorry. Excuse me. Ruben Foster is the
Is that a player? Oh, there you
Ruben
go.
Ruben Foster, yeah, played linebacker at Alabama. He was from Georgia.
Yes,
he was notoriously known for getting an Auburn tattoo, and then as a commit and a senior, and then turning around and committing to Alabama.
Boom.
So that was an interesting recruitment. But yeah, Ruben Owens, excuse me, the number one running back, five star out of Texas. So a lot of people were like, he's going to Texas, and then completely pulled an okie doke and ended up at Louisville. NLI, baby. And so we'll see if that stands. A lot of people feel like that's not going to stand, that, you know, Texas will end up getting them. And again, you know, it's one of those things where people are like, oh, you know, there's certain schools and they're paying money up front. And I'm not making any allegations or anything. I'm just saying that this is the conversation that people are having. And they think that there's no way that you can renege on that commitment because somebody gave you money to commit to a school. It's BS, man. I'm telling you right now that the kids can give the money back if they want to or not. It's just not going to matter. At the end of the day, you're not going to be able as a collective to go to court and sue some kid over some money you gave them, because it's going to make it look bad, like you induced him to go to that school. And that's going to be against the NCAA. Now, if that rules change down the line, then that's different. But right now, as the rules are, if you are inducing recruits to go to schools and giving them money to go to specific school to do specific things, that is absolutely against the rules. And you would be potentially putting your team in a situation where the school that you're affiliated with, you give them the death penalty because of something like that. So it's not going to happen. So that's why people still look at Ruben Owens committing to Louisville going, that might not stand. Knowing that obviously there's got to be a great NIL deal. No disrespect to Louisville fans. I don't want to slight your football program, but obviously it's not a Power Five school. It's not Texas. It's not a big boy. So, you know, you can sit here and say, well, he really has a great, you know, relationship with the coaching staff and he's going to play early and this, that, and the other. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, that existed last year too, and the year before. And, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things. You start to see outlier schools land guys like that out of nowhere. You know, everybody's going to look at it and say, well, there's going to be some NIL factors there.
And yeah, I would have just said the running backs, if like one of them or both of them had like, you know, really, really good season senior years, and, you know, a bunch of SEC and Texas schools try to make another run. That was my only kind of real logical reason for picking any of those guys right now. This one comes from Kevin. Do you think it's Texas A&M letting Malachi Nelson take a look inside the Brinks vault, or more so that he wants to go to a school where he can start immediately?
No, I don't think it has anything to do with I've spoken to his, you know, his dad and him about this ad nauseum. They love Caleb Williams. They're really tight. Yeah. They look at him as a mentor. He's one of those guys that they feel like they actually benefit playing behind him and watching him, not just, you know, handle business on the field, but handle business off the field. You know, there's a lot going on there, which I think is definitely working in USC's advantage with Caleb Williams being there. I think that, you know, I was told flat out by people very close to Malachi Nelson that this had a lot to do with NIL. And I think also, you know, maybe as other factors though, is that, you know, USC, again, offensive line recruiting, we know that Alabama used that to get Bryce Young to kind of sort of, to loosen him up on his commitment. And then when Clay Helton looked like he was going to be fired when they lost that BYU game. That was just, you know, added fuel to just, you know, dislodge him from that commitment completely. That's not going to happen with USC this time around. You know, Lincoln Riley is not going anywhere. So the stability there is going to be a lot to keep Malachi Nelson committed. The NIL factors are still there. But like I said, you know, we've seen some evolution of the Boulevard. We've seen some things, and I'm sure they're very well aware of the Malachi Nelson situation. And I'm sure that, you know, they're just working to make sure that he feels comfortable with the opportunities he's going to have at USC, you know, financially and brand building and everything else.
This one is a two-part question that comes from D from the Central Valley. They're both directed at you, Gerard. So, Gerard, on the P, you mentioned David Peavy recently. I believe you said USC really likes him, and about 2 weeks ago you mentioned USC is in a good position for him, but it got silent. Do you think SC's chances on him – do you like SC's chances of getting him committed? The second question, Gerard, you also mentioned that SC is still talking to local committed offensive linemen. How strong is the Eliza Jacket commitment to Washington? Hopefully it's like the commitment of Dalen Austin has to LSU. Thank you for you two in the age of NIL. Following recruiting is not as fun. but both of you have made it more enjoyable. Thank you, D.
Yes. First question, David Peavy. I don't think he went silent for USC. I think in that conversation we were talking about Shelby kind of going silent with Texas. To my knowledge, Peavy has been in communication with USC for a while, and you know, there's been some confidence there with him, but it is basically Oregon and USC, and I think right now both schools feel confident. I think both schools feel like they're going to get him. I don't know that he has really made any overtures to one school or the other. It's probably just going to be one of those things where he may not tell one of the schools where he's going, and he's just going to commit, and they're going to find out that way. Yeah, we're going to have to wait and see how that goes. We actually heard he might commit last week. So that's coming on, obviously, but that was I didn't say that because I wasn't sure. That was sort of a source through a source that told me that. Yeah, he obviously did not commit. And so we're kind of still waiting to see what happens. And then, you know, does the Braylon Shelby commitment affect him at all? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, he was on the official visit with Braylon Shelby, and USC has been recruiting them both pretty aggressively. So that's where that stands with David Peavy. Second question, in terms of Eliza Jacket. Yeah, I mean, I think USC feels like they can circle the wagons on some of these local players, sort of like they did with Malachi Crawford. I think Eliza Jacket falls into that category where they feel like they've got enough to offer, and if they win those games during the season, they'll be able to go back and they'll be able to recruit him. They don't have to make a big push early or anything. Just kind of keep certain bodies warm that you liked. And they liked him. I mean, they really did recruit him pretty hard early in the spring. Josh Henson spent time with him personally on junior day, and he came away feeling like he was a priority recruit. Now, I think that sort of changed because he never came in on an official visit. And that sort of tells you a little bit. The guys that they really wanted to make a push for, they brought in on unofficial visits. And the guys they felt like they could probably recruit harder later if they didn't get somebody else on the board, those guys I think they've waited to have their official visits later in the year. So Eliza Jacket still has official visits he can take, and he could take an official visit to USC. So that would be something that they probably would do later on the line if they felt like, you know, they didn't have other options.
And this isn't a question. It's just a comment on us, or someone just wanted to make a comment for us to read. This is from Alan. Chris and Gerard, don't get me wrong. I enjoy recruiting and the weird drama as much as the next Peristyle member, but those verbal commitments don't mean much until the player is accepted and enrolled at the university. So I'm pleased that we are starting to have some success recruiting offensive line and bolstering our defense, Tackett Curtis. But early sign day is almost 5 months away. Hopefully the Trojans play well and flip some of the players that committed elsewhere. Absolutely love Gerard's comment about Oregon being the smartest kid at the continuation school. Gerard, I've gotten multiple people tell me that they love that line. So great burn, Gerard. That was me. That wasn't what Alan said. This is back to Alan. Keep up the great work and fight on, Cilantro boys. Seriously, who doesn't like Cilantro? 1997 Trojan on the P. I like cilantro, Gerard. I don't know if you're one of those people that get the soap taste or whatever.
No, I like cilantro. Yeah.
Oh, damn. You even said it like, legit.
Cilantro?
Yeah, cilantro. You said it like legit.
Oregano? You got oregano? Got R's, my guy. I mean, you said.
Tabarucci, cilantro.
Somebody said for La Raza, and you butchered that. You said,
look, man. La Raza. Look, man. Chill
you
out.
The Tabarachi. Chill out over there. You were on the Tabarachi faction there. You know, Tabarachi. Actually, it's Tabarachi. It's not Tabarucci. Even though Tabarucci. Chill Tabarucci out. Is so much funner to say.
All right, Gerard. We have 5 questions sent in by one person. Tariq sent in 5 questions. And these aren't like I stored them up over multiple weeks. This was all for 1 week. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to trade questions back and forth. So you're going to get the first one, and then you're just going to answer. And then I'm going to get the next one, and I'm going to answer. And then you're going to get the next one, and you're going to answer. Does that make sense?
Okay, you want me to go and try to read the questions to you?
No, I'm going to read them. I'm going to read them regardless.
All right, go.
So you're up first. SC seems to historically struggle with recruiting out of Washington. Outside of on-the-field credibility, why do the majority of the top prospects from the state do not choose USC?
there's not really any connections up there. You don't have any coaches in the coaching staff that are from Washington, or they haven't had much time recruiting that particular area. It's all about contacts. So USC, you know, they look like they were going to be good in Washington when they had Johnny Nance, and then they had that group that came down from Washington, and they did get some guys that were decent players. I mean, they have recruited some good players from Washington, but recently it's been obviously more about Texas, and they had the majority of coaches on the coaching staff under Clay Helton were from Texas. And so kind of hard for those guys to go up to Washington. It's a different culture, you know, different group of people. It kind of goes back to what we talked about with recruiting by position versus recruiting by area. And so didn't have a lot of representation in the Northwest. They don't necessarily have to. It's not like, you know, you've got to recruit Washington to get the best players out of Washington to be competitive in the Pac-12 or nationally. It's good, you know, to be another place that you can go in and you can pluck players out of. But certainly, I mean, I would say Arizona is probably even more important. And even the Bay Area in Northern California, which USC has been terrible at recruiting over the years, is more important. So, you know, you just, I think in terms of your connections and your ability to have people on the ground that you know and you trust to be able to help you evaluate who's who and who's legit, and also to just have ears on the ground as to kind of what's going on in a recruitment is very important. And USC has not had that very often.
Next question goes to me. Can you give some insight into the relationship or lack thereof between USC and St. John Bosco? It's almost as if the coaches steer their kids away from SC. I wouldn't say that. The relationship between USC and Bosco has been interesting. It seems to go through sort of these phases where it's high and then it's low and then it's high and then it's low. Obviously, when I started covering sports in Southern California, you know, Bosco was just beginning their kind of rise with that national championship, and USC was involved. Obviously, they got, you know, Damian Mama, who was a big-time offensive lineman, and Malik Dorton was also in that class. And then it kind of – you didn't really see any Bosco players really kind of go to USC. And then recently, USC sort of had a sort of revival with Bosco. You know, there's plenty of Bosco Braves on the roster right now. You have Jude Wolf. Chris Steele, you know, he was on the team last year, but he was a big get from Bosco eventually through the portal. Kobe Pepe, Raylan Goforth, Will Rose, the walk-on punter, and then walk-on Mac Colombo at running back. He's also, you know, a Brave. So they have a bunch of Braves' fingerprints and footprints all over this team, and that's obviously a school that Lincoln Riley made a trip to early. That's a school he knows that he has to keep that relationship up and sort of strengthen that strengthen that relationship. Bosco isn't, I would consider, sort of a quote-unquote pipeline school for USC, but it's definitely a school where they can go in and offer kids and get kids. There's a bunch of guys that they've offered now and that would love to get, you know, Jordan Lockhart, Marcellus Williams, Kingston, the linebacker. I'm going to butcher his last name, so I won't. Peyton Woodyard. So there's a bunch of guys that they've offered on the staff. I know it's more considered, I guess, a UCLA school, if you want to actually deem it a school, but Ohio State has had success there. You know, Washington's had success there. So Stanford has had success there. So St. John Bosco doesn't really have a pipeline to any sort of college, and it has really good relationship with a bunch of college. So I wouldn't say there's a lack of relationship there. It just has been an up and down kind of thing under the Clay Helton era. And I think Lincoln Riley, you know, that's a guy that's really well respected, and I think that's a guy who's going to really strengthen and fortify that pipeline moving forward. So I would say they're in a good spot with St. John Bosco. Obviously, there's a guys they're recruiting for the 2024 class and the 2023 class. So we'll see that. I think we'll see that continue to strengthen over the next couple of years. Back to Gerard. What are USC's chances with Nicholas Harbor, being that they have a top five track program? Harbor's player analysis makes him seem like a developmental project at the next level, regardless of position. What position do you feel like he has the most potential for him?
Yeah, so I think they have a good a shot as any. I think USC is among his top three. I think he has very high interest in USC. Certainly, There's a little bit of a question as to whether he goes football or track, because he has been that successful in track. As a player, if he does go football route, I lean towards him being more of a defender and more of a defensive end, just because I still have a lot of questions as to how good of a receiver he is. You know, if you're going to put him at tight end, you know, that's a little more of a football position. That's a little more of a, you have to be a natural pass catcher. You can't just be fast and big and be a great tight end. You have to catch the ball, and you also have to block. Whereas if you're defensive end, you can use raw athleticism and still be pretty successful as a pass rusher. So I would lean more to him playing defense. I think with USC, they've talked about him playing both. I don't know recently if the conversation has been weighted more one towards the other. I got the vibe initially listening to him talk to Jared Perez, our intern who spoke to him at the Mount Sac Relays. I wrote the story for the interview. Audio-wise, I got the vibe like he kind of wants to play a tight end receiver role more. And again, stands to reason, said it at the beginning of the podcast, you know, kids always want to be looked at as being, you know, that more athletic version of position-wise than maybe they are, right? And it's like, more athletic, how more athletic can you be than, you know, running a 10-2 and being 6'5", 235 pounds? I don't mean it that way. I mean the perception. It's the perception of the position you play. So if you play defensive end, that's looked at more like a lineman position. And so it's not as flashy. It's not as finesse as if you were a tight end hybrid wide receiver like a Drake London type. So that's always with kids. You know, they again, if you're a defensive end, you want to be looked at as a linebacker. If you're a linebacker, you want people to look, you say, oh, well, he could play safety because he's athletic enough. That just is part of the recruiting process. And coaches entertain those whims a lot just to get kids on campus and to get them recruited and to get them committed. At the end of the day, though, you have to kind of strip those fantasies away and say, hey, listen, this is what you do well. This is where you need to play and sell that position then and get that player to buy in playing that position.
Next one goes to me. How much do you think USC's recruiting board gets shuffled if they win 10-plus games? Do you believe recruits like Jerrion Dickey, DeAndre Moore Jr., Walker Lyons, Lucas Simmons, and Dalen Austin end up with USC with that type of season? Well, I think their board will get shuffled a lot. Obviously, they're going to be a lot more. They're going to be a hot product. They're going to be talked about a lot on the national scene on ESPN and talking heads and college football, and they're going to have a lot of buzz. So naturally, I think kids are going to be drawn to the buzz. And if they're winning 10-plus games, you know, they're putting up some impressive wins on the field. You know, maybe that's a Utah win. Maybe that's a Notre Dame win as well. So I think they'll definitely have a bunch of buzz, and I think a lot of kids that maybe were committed elsewhere, local kids, will start to look at them a little differently, and maybe they'll have a lot more pull with these guys and get them on campus for maybe an official visit that they have saved up, or guys will be back on for an unofficial visit or a game day, stuff like that. So absolutely any of those guys you listed on there, I could definitely see them ending up, multiple of those guys ending up in the class. Walker Lyons may be a little bit different if they do get Deuce Robinson and they do, you know, keep Cade Eldridge, they could take three tight ends. So definitely he could be in there. Lucas Simmons, absolutely, depending on what Florida State does. If Florida State's struggling and USC's winning 10-plus games, absolutely they could recircle there. Dalen Austin, join the recruiting process, absolutely. DeAndre Moore, with whatever what happens with Louisville, we'll see. But it's a possibility. USC already has that third wide receiver spot filled by the time, so maybe not him. But Jerrion Dickey, he's that third receiver. So we'll kind of see where that goes. But definitely they're going to have a chance to pick up some higher-end guys for this class if they're winning 10-plus games. And Gerard, final question. USC has recently targeted a number of new receivers in the 2023 class. Can you give us your thoughts on the skill sets of Jacoby Lane, Orlando Greenlow, Jaron Hamilton, and Jerrion Dickey? Specifically, who do you feel is the best of the group? Gerard, I just want to say we have broken down these guys before. So if you just want to talk about who you feel like where their strengths are, that's fine as well.
Yeah, I would say check out last week's podcast, because we actually went into detail about these guys and sort of what they bring to the table. And you actually left Malachi Coleman off the list. Now, I know Malachi Coleman has been recruited mostly by Roy Manning, because Malachi Coleman does play kind of a hybrid defensive end linebacker position as well, but is also rated as a receiver. So he's just kind of a big athlete, but obviously different. We talked about it then, than Lane or Greenlow. Greenlow, I have not seen film on, so I can't tell you really what Greenlow's actual strengths are and attributes are as a receiver, mostly a basketball player as I know him. But obviously being a basketball player and being tall, you would think that, you know, he'd be a 50-50 ball type guy. He'd be a guy that could go up for the ball and play. But in terms of his route running and his speed and everything, still kind of an unknown to us. With Lane, he is much more of a pure receiver. He's very slight, but he, you know, has some decent speed. I think his speed has improved, and that's where you've seen the later scholarship offers. He's been able to put some stuff on film where he's being a little more quicker. He's being able to get off the line quicker and not being so easy to press as a 6'5 receiver. But he's a guy that plays finesse, and he plays pretty high up, kind of maybe a poor man's Dwayne Jarrett from watching him on film. Definitely a big receiver, but not necessarily a big physical receiver, more of a guy that is sort of a vertical type of threat up the field, who makes a lot of plays sort of above the defender. Jaron Hamilton, haven't seen much of him. USC offered him a while ago. I haven't really watched any film on him. I can't really speak to him. Jerrion Dickey is clearly the best of the group. He's the most physical. He's proven the most on the circuit that he can be consistent as a pass catcher. He was originally rated as an athlete by 24/7 Sports because he plays some defensive back. And so that kind of shows you his versatility in terms of his agility, his balance, and things that he can do outside of just catching the football. So catching the football was really the question, how natural of a pass catcher was he? And he showed during the circuit that he very much is a very good pass catcher. He's very good hands. What does USC have in terms of the shot at any of these players? We know that Lane kind of favoring Oregon originally because they were on him first. Greenlow, kind of an unknown, not really sure where he stands with schools necessarily. You know, he's a guy that has really just sort of picked up his recruitment lately. I think with Dickey, it's going to be harder. He's not going to transfer to Modern Day, as we had been told earlier in the year. Looks like he's going to stay in the Bay Area, and I've talked about it. USC has not had very much success in the Bay Area. They haven't really recruited the Bay Area very hard, so I think their connections there are just not that great. I will say that Zach Hansen went up to the Bay Area to recruit Walker Lyons and some other players. So they do have somebody that is originally from that area, because Zach Hansen's actually originally from Northern California, recruiting those areas now. That will help them probably in the future. I don't know how much contact he had with Dickey, and you know what the conversations were with that. It seems like Oregon and then Miami are the two schools that are really out in front for Dickey the most. You got to get him on campus at some point. You know, he's not a recruit for you. He's not really a target for you unless he's willing to make that trip to USC and get on campus. So if he was at Modern Day, that would be much easier to do at this point. You know, he might as well be in Alaska if you've been in the Bay Area. I know that sounds crazy. It's like, what do you mean, Gerard? You know, that's like a 5-hour drive. Like, you know, you can get to the Bay Area from to USC and not even have to fly. But those kids just never seem to unofficially visit USC. Just seems like you just do not get a lot of those kids down here. But I think, you know, with Noah potentially committing, USC obviously making a move with Amos Talalele, they may be doing a little better job at this point getting those kids on campus. I think they did a better job with junior days, getting some of those kids on campus from the Bay Area. But it's still very much a work in progress. And it just seems like once you get north of Fresno, man, those kids just don't show up for game days very often. So that's going to be something that if they want to recruit Jerrion Dickey, they're going to really have to make that concerted effort and push for it. And considering that you have these other scholarships that are now on the board recently, tells me that they're not necessarily confident that's going to happen.
Okay. Gerard, we wrapped up our Tariq section of questions, and that's it. We're clean. We're done. We're at the end of our podcast. I know people have been like, the last two have been only 2 hours. I want 2+ hours. Well, I gave you 2+ hours. We've gone 2+ hours. We're back on track, ladies and gentlemen. The two-star composite is back to 2+ hours. You're welcome. Gerard, Anything else you want to say before we get out of here?
No. We'll continue to bring you the latest from fall camp. Hopefully we can get more interesting, diverse information and some observations from what's going on. Give you some info on Bobby Haskins and, you know, some of the other players at other positions. And you know, it's hard to do that when they're just going through warmups and walkthroughs. But that's just the access that we're being in for right now. So hopefully in the future, you know, it opens up a little more and we can get a little more and we can convey that to you guys.
Okay, you heard it there. I'm Chris. That's Gerard. This has been the Composite Two-Star Recruits, and thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
That leopard sucks!
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right!
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.